Hello again, friends, and you are my friends, and welcome to another edition of 605, the Super Podcast, the Mothership, your favorite show. And I am the great Brian Lass, and once again here with me, popular wrestling journalist and host of the popular juicing podcast In the Mix with Bix, David Bixenspan.
What type of juicing?
You tell me. Actually, that's a very good question, Bix. With all the articles that you've written about the WBF, it could be any kind of juicing, I guess. How's your striation? I always know what to say to Pop Bix, in case anyone hasn't noticed yet.
By the way, did you see the WBF-related news this week?
No, what's the WBF-related news?
That Shane McMahon posted a video of him training with his strength and conditioning trainer, Jim Quinn.
What? Get out of here.
Yes.
Wow.
Well,
I think I would be training with Cameo Newer, right? Host of Body Stars, that failure that was on every Saturday morning. Thanks, Vince. Well, before we get going with follow-ups and everything, I did want to say something to you, because when my father said this to me, I thought, I got to tell Bix this.
Okay.
And I'll save it for on the air. My father doesn't really care for wrestling. You know, like his favorite moment ever going to wrestling with me was when Roddy Piper pulled down Rick Rude's pants in the cage. He thought that was hysterical. You know, he was drinking. And he thought it was the funniest thing ever. But he called me up the other day. He's like, Brian, I just saw some wrestling on TV. I was like, oh, really? What'd you see, Pop? He goes, I saw two things. One called Roughhouse Wrestling, and it's the worst thing I've ever seen. I was like, okay, well, what's the other one? He goes, Global Wrestling on ESPN. I'm like, oh, yeah, sure. That used to be on every day when I got home from school at 4 o'clock. He goes, yeah, I watched Scott Putski. And I was like, yep, that's Ivan Putski's son. And he teamed with some guy, I think Luscious Gary. I was like, probably Gorgeous Gary Young, I would assume. And he said that their opponents were this can't be right. The Slip House Boys. Bix? He said, the Slip House Boys, he thinks their name was Sun and Fun. Who could he possibly be thinking about Sun and
Fun? And they were facing
Fun?
Gary Young and who?
Scott Putski.
The Slip House Boys, what? What were their
Sun and Fun.
Okay. Wait. Did you attempt to Google this?
No, I figured I'll save it for the show and see if your mind goes into a wormhole.
Crap. I don't know.
I guarantee there was no one named the Slip House Boys, and my father just...
I hope not. Is a slip house an actual thing?
I don't know. I mean, it sounds like it should be. I may know a few people who have gone to the slip house.
Sun and Fun. Okay, wait. So Scott Putzky's there, so this is probably at least 1992.
Mm-hmm. With Gary Young as a tag team.
So Gary, I don't remember Gary Young being a face in Global.
Well, when you have to go against Sun and Fun, the Slip House Boys, it makes the fans.
Okay, really, I have to Google this for a second. You reminisce
I'll
about your memories.
You
about, yes,
I'll talk while
boys.
You Google. I want to do a few follow-ups from last week while Bix goes deep into the Slip House. One, I had mentioned last week as part of the segment about funny fan moments that I remembered being in 1995 in Lenoir, North Carolina, and there was a woman there with a couple children, and she was chanting something along the lines of, Tracy, ooh, see, over and over again. We couldn't make out what it was. I always figured she must have been saying something, and actually, in one of the more stunning revelations that have happened since we started doing the show, I don't know if the person wants his name out there, and quite frankly, his Twitter name isn't his real name anyway, but someone got in touch with us, and if you're listening, out of respect for you, I'm not saying who you are, just in case, he said, yeah, that was my mom. We regularly went to shows in Lenoir, North Carolina, and she couldn't think of anything that rhymed with Tracy, so she just made up the word Usi. I was like, oh, okay. And another thing, my dad was Ricky Morton's connection. Whatever you think that may be, it probably is. So that was one of the highlights of my Twitter exchanges in the last week, finding out who this woman was, that she's the mother of a listener, and that his father was the connection to the Express.
You know, that reminds me, you know what's something that should be on YouTube in one of its iterations, whether it's from his shoot interview or from Fan Week or whatever?
What's that?
Buddy Landell's impression of Ricky Morton smoking crack.
Oh, he used to do it all the time. That's not on YouTube anywhere?
I don't think so.
Yeah. That that was when Buddy cleaned up so he thought he could make fun of other people who smoking crack.
I just remember it was like he's paranoid that the Shiite Muslims are coming to get him, and that they're going to like somehow climb into his window. And it's like, but Ricky, we're on the 22nd floor. But they've got suction cups.
That's right. That's exactly what it was. He did that in 1995 at the Heel Barbecue for Smoky Mountain Wrestling. That was the first time I saw him do it. And I saw him do it a few other times after that. It became a very popular bit for his comedy routine, Buddy Landell.
By the way, so the no results for the Slip House Boys on Google. I'm checking Wrestling Data's encounters thing to see if I can find matches where Scott Putski teamed with
Yeah, I think that would be better because I'm going to guess they are the Slip House Boys. And my father just wasn't paying close enough attention and came up with this. Now we need to like create a team, the Slip House Boys. But
okay, here's what we've got. I don't like, so far I don't see anything with them on the same team. Is it possible that they were actually opponents?
I can only tell you what he told me.
Okay, wait. We've got Terry Sims, Gary Young, and Scott Putski defeated John Tatum, Rod Price, and Stephen Dane. Scott Putski and Gary Young defeated the Viper and Stephen Dane. No. It ended without a winner.
What was the name of the team of Tatum and Price?
Okay, wait. Yes, they did wrestle them. They were the Coast to Coast Connection or the California Connection. They were the Coast to Coast Connection with when Sweet Daddy Falcone joined up.
So okay,
that's what I'm. I was thinking it might be them.
Yeah, I mean that's not Sun and Fun or Slip House, so.
Unless they did some wacky thing where they were masked as the Slip House Boys. Sun and Fun.
I'm telling you now, maybe something with Sun and Fun Connection that would make a little more sense. I'm willing to bet there are no Slip House Boys in the history of professional wrestling.
They also defeated Billy Travis in ball pain. They defeated Rod Price and Tatum in another match.
Boy, Global really took a nice turn after Eddie left, didn't it? It went right from Eddie Gilbert booking right into the Slip House.
Well, is the Slip House actually a thing?
Look it up, Bix. You're the Google king.
Okay, define Slip House.
Yeah,
actually, no. I have a better idea. Let me grab my phone. Let's see.
You're going to call a Slip House?
No. What is a Slip House?
According to The Guardian, Slip House is a flexible, eco-minimalist haven that successfully reimagines the urban terraced home. This translucent, three-story house rises ethereally from a row of traditional Victorian houses in South London.
Yeah.
Yeah, clearly that's the right answer.
Hold on. Let me try that, too. Let me turn the volume.
Wait, what do you have? Do you have an iPhone or?
Yeah, I have an iPhone.
Okay, so you're going to get a different answer from me.
Yeah. Hey, Siri. What is a slip house? Where's my microphone?
Where Bix lives.
What?
Where Bix lives?
Supposed to be Libs, this fucking app. God damn it. All right.
Wait, did they say it's answers to what is the slip house is where Bix lives?
Yeah.
How did...
Wait, hold on. Wait.
What?
Wait. Wait, I don't understand. Whoa, there's a fly that just landed on my desk. Whoa, hold on. I got to kill this fucker. And I killed it with my show notes. That's not good.
This is why you should not do that on paper.
Well, you know, I like to write things. I know you you don't really like that.
That's because my handwriting is terrible.
Oh, man. Let me try Siri again. Hold on. Someone just texted me. Siri, who lives in the slip house?
Bix and Akeem Bix and Span.
Oh, Bix and Akeem Bix and Span. There we go.
Bix and Akeem Bix and Span.
Yep. All right. Well, moving right along.
How did it do that?
I have all sorts of weird apps. You have no idea.
Is this really Siri? Or
no,
is
it's a thing that mirrors Siri's voice. So you can play pranks on people like your, podcast friends. Oh boy. Well,
I don't have an iPhone, so I would not know of such things. That's fantastic, though.
Another follow-up for us. We had Scott Teal on for two episodes, and we got a really great reaction to his interview, and we're definitely gonna have Scott on again in the future. We really had a good time with that. But he sent me an email to let me know that the book Bruiser, I guess that's the official title now of the Dick the Bruiser biography that he's working on, Bruiser goes to the print, is at the printer actually right now as we speak, and it should be available at the end of March. So start paying attention to crowbarpress.com. And if you order that or any other books from Scott, just let him know you heard about it here on 605 from your friends Bix and Brian. And the last follow-up is the one that Bix is the most excited about, Yama Pit Fighting. So we did a poll. I said last week's show that I didn't think it would be right to just talk about a mixed martial arts thing, even though it's a funny story and there's lots of little angles and twists and turns and wrestling people involved. I didn't think it would be right to just, you know, hit our audience over the head with that. And I said, I'll do a poll on Twitter. And if 2/3 of the audience say they want to hear it, we'll do something. Bix, what was the final tally? Tally-ho?
I think it was something like 72-28.
72-28. So that is more than 2/3. So here's what we're going to do. What I'm thinking is Yama happened in April of 2008. We're going to do something in April for Yama. I'm debating right now if it'll be on 605 or if we'll do a special supplemental episode, Superstars on the Superstation, as Bix's.
No, Superstars on the Super Podcast.
Superstars on the Super Podcast or something along those lines. Exile on 605, maybe we'll call it. And we'll do a special Yama-only episode so that people who don't care about mixed martial arts can skip it. Or if you want to hear just some wacky stories of things I've been involved in my business career, you get to hear my tale of being an executive for the parent company of Yama Pit Fighting. Bix, fair? You think that's good?
Yes. Yama Stars on the Super Podcast? Nah.
I don't know. When Yama first started, there was one M. And then Live Nation said, hey, you should add two M's. So it's Y-A-M-M-A. And actually made sense. So.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wait, so, well, it's not an English word anyway. So, like, what would the transliteration, does it matter what the transliteration would be?
I don't know if I should say too much right now because that may go into one of the early punchlines on the okay. Official Yama show.
If you say so.
Yeah. I actually listened back to an old appearance I made on Figure Four Daily with Brian Alvarez when Yama happened. And I was talking a little bit about it there. And I also tell the bar mitzvah story there, of course. And it's funny to listen to. But yeah, April, Yama's coming up. Also in April, we're going to do something special for the Freebirds. We're working on now a couple different segments that we think will be really cool that fans of the Freebirds will really dig. Because as we found out this week, the Freebirds are going into the World Wrestling Entertainment Hall of Fame. Bix, are you as up in arms as everyone else about Jimmy Jam Garvin being inducted?
I'm just sad that Sunshine, the Angel of Death, Iceman King Parsons, Bad Street, Big Daddy Dink, and Diamond Dallas Page aren't going in.
What about David Wolfe?
Now, is David Wolfe actually a Freebird?
He managed the Freebirds in the World Wrestling Federation.
Okay, so David Wolfe. Oh, and Steve Cox.
Was Steve Cox a Freebird in 88?
Okay, so I had a discussion with someone about this on Twitter when I tweeted about this. He said that at least like once or twice Cox and Hayes were introduced as the Freebirds.
I don't remember that. That's when Michael Hayes went babyface against Buddy Roberts and the Samoans?
Yes.
You know what the sad thing is? Remember when Michael Hayes made up with the Von Erichs at his concert and he was about to have the Von Erichs sing a song when they were attacked? That's like one of the biggest like what ifs in wrestling history.
Because we didn't hear the Von Erichs sing a song.
Yeah, I wanted to hear the Von Erichs sing. I want to hear Kerry sing anything.
Well, we heard Chris sing when he was a kid.
What do you mean?
You've never heard that?
What are you talking about?
Chris Von Erich released a single called My Dad Can Beat Your Dad.
No, I did not hear that.
Okay, I think it's on YouTube, so vamp for a minute while I get it.
Vamp for a minute? What does that mean? Blade my head and join the Guardian Angels? What is vamp for a minute?
And pretend to get kidnapped, yes.
Well, but who knows if Vampiro really was or wasn't kidnapped.
That's what Chris says, so just banter with yourself for a second while I go look.
I'll banter with myself for a second about the Slip House Boys and everything else. So, Yeah, I mean, the Freebirds, I don't know. Jimmy Garr, I mean, I guess I understand why. They want another person who isn't dead, and Michael Hayes pushed for him. But when you think of Hall of Fame run of the Freebirds, you think of everything up until 1988, 89, and you think of the original three. It's kind of like when Metallica went into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and that Robert, whatever his name is, the bass player who replaced Jason, came and he got inducted into the Hall of Fame. He had played on one bad album with them, and somehow that was enough to get inducted. Freebirds, Hayes, and Garvin were a team from 89 to 92. They, for the most part, had really, really bad matches. Jimmy Garvin was not good, and I'm a fan of Jimmy Garvin, of gorgeous Jimmy Garvin, from, you know, 83 until 87, early 87, right when he turned babyface. A little bit after that, too. He was all right. But by 88, I didn't want to see him. When it's him against Flair, I really didn't need to see that. And, yeah, I mean, it's just so weird, him going into the Hall of Fame.
Yes, I guess so. But I did find it. Do you want to hear Chris Von Erich singing?
Do we want to hear that, or Heaven Needed a Champion? Heaven needs a champion.
I've had enough of Glenn Gloza for my life.
Okay. Well, what about the girl who sang at a Texas stadium?
Well,
they had some like 14-year-old girls.
Wasn't that Glenn Gloza's daughter?
Was it?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Okay.
As long as it's not R-A-S-S-L-I-N, that's wrestling. All right. This is not the way I thought it would sound.
It's not easy for a boy like me to get along, though I was always taught to take care of myself. But when some big old bully starts in pushing me around, I sometimes have to have a little help.
Where's Gino Hernandez
and
when you
I'll
need him?
Say, my dad can whip your dad. My dad can whip your dad. But my dad is a nice guy and hardly ever loses his cool. Just a young lad, so if you think you're so bad, my dad can whip your dad and your whole family too. My dad can whip your dad. My dad can whip your dad. My dad is a nice guy and hardly.
My God.
What year is that? I mean, is that another Jimmy Papa?
This is it says circa 1984 on YouTube at least.
Whoa. Well, I mean, I know Bad Street USA actually got play on the radio down there, and it's actually a good song. Did that actually get played anywhere?
I hope not.
How did he not get beat up at school for putting out that record? That's like the Friday song that Rebecca Black did a few years ago. That's the equivalent of it. Can you imagine he brings that home to Fritz? I think it's great. Where's the denim? I think it's really great.
My dad never loses his temper. You know when I posted the Glenn Gloza singing wrestling about on YouTube and had about how it's not good and all that? I think his daughter – I think his daughter commented angrily at everyone making fun of it.
No.
Yes.
I mean, how do you defend that song?
You have to be a family member.
Yeah, geez.
Well,
I didn't know Chris Von Erich released a record. You just blew my mind with that. I mean, it was the worst thing I've ever heard. But I didn't know. At first it started out, it was just I didn't think it was going the way I thought it would go. And then it ended up being exactly what I thought it would be. Somehow that happened. That should have been his theme music when he was a wrestler for that short period of time.
I can't beat you up, but my dad can beat your dad.
Is there an actual vinyl single of that?
Yes.
Oh, man, that is a collector's item. Is it just like Chris by himself, or is it like Chris Von Erich and the Slip House Boys? Like, does he have like a band?
You beat me to getting that exact joke in.
I'm very quick and I'm very funny.
It is how our people deal with the struggles.
That's right. I always say that to Suzanne. I say, a Jew that's not funny, I have no respect for. Well, Bix, I think we got to move the show along just because you and I are enjoying it, but I think people may be about to PBA Diaz themselves out the window. What do you think is next on the agenda for us?
Let's look at the agenda at our Day at a Glance book here. Oh, Derek Dukes.
Oh, so will you tell the story of how this became a topic this week?
Someone, and I forgot who, so I apologize, tweeted this at us. It's part of a full AWA episode that's on YouTube. And so you have to go up to where it is in the video to find it. It's, let's see. It is about 40 minutes, 30 seconds into it's AWA April 1st, 1989. I, you know, I'm sure we'll have a link or whatever in the notes, but it's 04-01-89. And
yeah, last week we didn't have a video playlist because I didn't get the stuff to Alan Blackstock in time. And this week there's enough stuff on the show that I know we want to get into a video playlist that I'll make sure that we do it.
But anyway, Tommy Jammer has just defeated Colonel De Beers in some sort of $2,500 challenge where he won $2,500 of Colonel De Beers' money. And then Colonel De Beers relayed a challenge he was issuing to Derek Dukes via Larry Nelson. And
this is extraordinary for a few reasons. One, Derek Dukes doesn't really seem too worried about anything.
He's nonplussed.
Nonplussed to the max. The second is Larry Nelson absolutely seems like a Sliphouse boy here. He is reacting like I've never seen any announcer react ever. It's a visual thing. We're going to play the audio because the audio actually is funny enough. But visually, when you see this, his eyes get wide at the high spot of the interview, and he makes a groan that I've never heard any announcer ever make in wrestling. But my favorite part may be, which you'll hear coming up. Actually, I shouldn't say anything. Why don't you play the interview? We'll talk about it after the fact, Bix.
But yes, he looks like he's Vince McMahon looking at striations.
Yeah, this is Larry Nelson on the verge of orgasm.
I hope not.
Well,
here we go.
There we go.
Tommy Jammer, ladies and gentlemen. Derek, I don't know how to get into this. This is the most outrageous thing I've ever heard of in my life. Did you by any chance hear this latest thing from Colonel De Beers?
No, what's that, Larry?
Colonel De Beers, standing at ringside with Lee Marshall, wants another wrestling match. He wants to wrestle you.
Yeah?
He says that if you win the wrestling match, he will give you $2,500.
Yeah? Okay, go on.
He says if he wins the wrestling match, he gets to paint you white.
You've got to be kidding me, Larry Nelson.
I'm not kidding at all. The man has gone right over the moon, Derek. I've never heard of anything like it. That's the situation. I know you're stunned. Can you give me a response of any kind?
You mean to tell me if I pin him in 10 minutes, correct, I get 25 smackaroos like Jammer just had, right?
25, well, not the same $2,500, but $2,500.
So he'll be out.
Had to make that distinction.
And you're trying to tell me if I don't, he'll paint me white?
That is exactly what he said. He wants to paint you white. Now, I know that this is a ridiculous situation. I don't know. I don't have no idea what to say, but that's it. What are you going to do about it?
Well, Larry, you know, I have a lot of pride in being black.
Absolutely.
And also my wrestling ability. But painting white.
I
tell you what, Larry. I'm going to accept that challenge, Colonel De Beers. One stipulation, Larry.
What's the stipulation?
If I pin him in 10 minutes,
right,
I get to paint him black.
Paint Colonel De Beers black?
Right. Could you see him going around with a black face, Larry Nelson?
No. Ladies and gentlemen, the challenge accepted by Derek Dukes. Paint Colonel De Beers black. Derek, this is going to be big news all over the world.
Wow.
Area, we had great wrestling action.
I just wanted to let that music play out because it seemed fitting.
First of all, my first favorite part is where he goes, you know, he's like very calm. He's like, okay, I'll do it, but I have a stipulation. Larry Nelson, as intense as possible, goes, what's the stipulation?
And it was more longing. It was like, what's the stipulation?
This whole interview, if you watch it, Larry Nelson's just staring Derek Dukes in the eye, and he's very close to him. And
deep breaths.
The whole thing is the most ridiculous thing. It makes me want to just go back and watch tons of Larry Nelson.
Actually, I really should watch the thing on WWE Network where he's complaining about his orthopedic chair because I still haven't watched that.
Did he write a book? Am I wrong to think
Write a book? Have you ever read it?
I never read it.
It's lurid.
Okay. Any good parts?
It's a quick read. I would actually say if you can get it cheap or at the library or whatever, it's worth a look.
You're telling me to illegally download it, aren't you?
I don't even know if there's an ebook version.
Oh.
And I don't think there are any enterprising internet pirates who would have scanned it.
Bix, do we know what happened? Like, what was the result of the match?
I honestly don't know.
Who is painted?
Oh boy, is this another one to look at wrestling data for?
Oh, are you gonna make me vamp again? What's the stipulation? He's so excited by the stipulation that he orgasms. And he looks like a dirty Santa to begin with.
he sounds like if Dick Graham and Gene Okerlin had a baby that was calling a wrestling match. That's what that sound sounds like.
Yeah, well, he looks at Derek Dukes lovingly like he's Cal Rudman. So, I mean, it's a whole bunch of like that era of announcers in Philadelphia that work fine for this. One day we got to do a whole Cal Rudman thing. I should see if we can get in touch with him.
That's a job for you then with your whole with your music connections.
Yeah, he's the publisher of Friday Morning Quarterback. Although by this point he has to be an old man. I know he's down in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I wonder how with it he still is. I don't think he actively does anything for Friday Morning Quarterback anymore. It's just that he owns it. Friday Morning Quarterback was a music industry publication that dealt a lot with radio, I guess would be the best summary.
His big thing was that he was really good at picking which songs were going to be hits, right?
Right, but how do I say this without getting sued? There's a book called Hitmen out there, which anybody can read.
You're saying that it would not surprise you if that was because he knew who was paying for airplay.
That is what I am saying. That is what Bix is saying. Let me correct that.
Well, I'm not saying that he did pay to anyone. I'm saying that he knew who was getting paid.
There's a book called Perhaps. It is actually one of the best books about the industry, of the music industry, about the business in the 80s and then the 70s too. But if you want stories about payola and cocaine and all sorts of wild craziness, Walter Yetnikoff stories, you can never get enough of those. That is a great book. And it deals with Cal Rudman. So imagine me sitting there reading this years and years ago. And I'm like, Cal Rudman? Like, oh my God. This is a guy that looked like he wanted to rape Don Morocco.
Okay, if we're going by these results, there are only four results. I'm guessing this is incomplete. These all look like spot show results. So I'm guessing none of these are the match, though, because we've got a Derek Dukes win in September, and then the rest are Colonel De Beers wins. Or no, there's one draw, too, but I don't think any of these are TV taping. Unless it wasn't a TV taping, I don't know. But so yeah, I don't know who got painted what color. I don't know if I want to know.
Well, Bix, can you get back into this room so we could? I got it right up to the groan. I want to play the groan one more time.
Okay, one second.
I think I got it right to the.
Yeah, I closed out of it. Okay.
Yeah, it says I am now owner of the room. Remember, with great power comes great responsibility.
Okay. And it just disappeared. Oh, there it is.
All right,
I'm Curved Egyptian Mao is the name that Sync Video gave me.
Boy, the audience is hearing all the behind the scenes stuff that goes on with this show
today. Okay, let's see. And I should make a drop of this to just play at random times.
Yeah, you got it.
Is it playing? Why isn't it playing?
I'll play.
Yeah. Well, no, you can't. I can't. I'm not going to. We're not going to hear it if you play it.
Oh, is that how it works?
Yeah, you don't have it. Wait, let's see. Do you have it at the right time?
Let me try.
Do you have it? Keep pausing it or something?
I paused it before to get to this moment. Let me try playing it.
Let's see what's
stipulation, Larry. What's the stipulation? If I pin him in 10 minutes,
right,
I get to paint him black.
Paint Colonel De Beers black?
Right. Could you see him going around with a black face, Larry Nelson?
No, I...
Wait, I'm an idiot. It's synced up, so of course you can click play and I can hear it.
Yeah, I don't know what's wrong with you over there.
Many, many things.
Ugh, Slip House Bix. All right, well, That's the Colonel DeBeers, Derek Dukes thing. Yeah, I think we may have to make a few of the things on here. What's the stipulation and the groan so we could use them as drops going forward? I did want to say one more thing that we're actively working on. We have a few guests for shows that are coming up that I think everyone's going to really like, a few Dennis of the Weeks that are good, and a few other guests for other old school wrestling topics that I think people really enjoy. There's one I'm actively working on, and I have a few people helping me out with it. A few weeks ago here on the show, we talked about Mark Gulin of the House Gulin and those fantastic
The House
promos.
Of Gulin.
Well, he calls it the House Gulin, and then later on he calls it the House of Gulin. But I'm Mark Gulin of the House Gulin. That's how he introduces the House Gulin. And he did these amazing interviews in Memphis in 1987. We're going to play them on the show probably next week or so, or a week after, one of these upcoming weeks. And these interviews are fantastic. He's got his outfit on. He's got this accent that's like a Southern Shakespeare. I don't know how to really describe it very much. And he does these amazing interviews building up to the debut of T-Joe Kahn the Great, who, if anyone has ever seen T-Joe Kahn, he certainly was not great. Although I did like him in Body Slam. And also,
now, was he Axe or Hammer?
I don't know, but he had the immortal line, you know, that goes up there with I'll make him an offer he can't refuse, and are you looking at me? The line that T.J. Khan had in cinema history is, your guitar needs tuning. And then he smashed the instruments of the band Kick, who were formerly Kicks, managed by M. Harry Smilak. But he has these introductory videos of T.J. Khan the Great, the House Gulin, and he builds up to Yo Mamba, the Jungle Savage, who we have not been able to find any photos or picture or videos of, so we don't know if who Yo Mamba was, and I need to see Yo Mamba the Jungle Savage. But we are actively working on getting Mark Gulin on the show, and I don't know why, but that's the guest I'm most excited about at this point. So stay tuned, but hopefully we'll have Mark Gulin on the show in the near future to find out the inner workings of House Gulin.
And he was also the Beast in Beauty and the Beast with Terry Garvin Sims.
He was, and he covered a lot of that when he was on Terry Garvin Sims' podcast. What's the name of his podcast again, Bix?
World Domination.
World Domination with Terry Sims. It's a really great show, actually. And I listened recently to the Mark Gulin episode, and they covered almost all just Beauty and the Beast. Nothing about House Gulin. That's what we're going to cover, because no one can cover that like we can here. So we'll deal with that and the cult following House Gulin has on an upcoming episode. Sometime soon. What's next, Bix? I killed a fly with my show notes.
I thought that would happen earlier.
Yeah, that did. That's why I don't know.
I thought you were providing live commentary.
What?
I thought you were saying that, oh, I just killed it. Never mind.
No, I was saying I don't have my notes because it happened earlier.
Oh.
As the listeners would have heard.
You wanted to do a what if Shawn Michaels went to WCW in...
Well,
no, there was actually something else we had before that. That's right.
Okay.
This was a topic we had wanted to discuss, and then we didn't fit it in last week, which was, the way you classified it, I think, was unheralded markout moments.
Well, when we talked about the world-class discussion a few weeks ago, and I thought about, you know, for whatever reason, one of those moments I always mark out for is the Von Erichs and the Freebirds introductions before the six-man match at Texas Stadium. The Freebirds coming out, Michael Hayes dancing the Bad Street, which had just debuted. And Buddy and Terry behind him. Terry looks like a badass holding the trophy. He looks like a badass with a cutoff shirt, with his midsection showing. Somehow Terry Gordy still looks like a badass. And then the Von Erichs come out, and it's just one of those matches. Fritz in his denim. One of those matches and one of those intros that I always mark out for. So I was trying to think of other things that, for whatever reason, I'm just a huge mark for. Like, doesn't even have to be a match, just a moment in wrestling. So one of the ones I thought of, Bix, was – and I couldn't find the video of it online because I wanted to actually just refresh myself. But it used to be on Coliseum Home Video, and it was on a couple other things. But in Minneapolis in 1984, summer of 84, when Mad Dog Vachon makes his debut for the World Wrestling Federation.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was a surprise or if it was announced. It seems like it was a surprise.
I think he had just – left the AWA like a couple days earlier.
He comes out and the place goes nuts, and he's like really into it, and he's like, you know, doing his poses and everything. And that's one of those moments that I can watch it over and over again. The match is awful. I forget who his opponent was, but it was, the guy was terrible.
Tiger Chung Lee.
No. It was a guy in purple, Pat something. He was like a foot taller than Mad Dog too. But the guy was
who
like,
wasn't.
It was like everything he did was like it was like he's right out of wrestling school. He would throw a punch and he'd do like a big stomp with it, so it was clear what like he didn't know what he was doing. But the pop that Vachon gets there is like one of those moments I just love. Well, what moments do you have, Bix?
One that I always think of and that I like to talk about a lot is when 1-2-3 Kid and Marty Jannetty won the tag titles from the Quebecers on the first anniversary episode of Raw.
Oh, that was January 94.
Yes.
Yeah, that was actually really good. That was a great match.
Well, because it's a great match, and then Randy Savage running in after they win, treating it like it's the biggest thing that ever happened anywhere.
I'm such a mark for heel Jacques Rougeau.
Oh, he was fantastic.
Oh, he was the best smarmy heel ever. And, you know, he was great with the Quebecers, and he was good as the Mountie, but I just like Rougeau Brothers heel Jacques Rougeau, where he's coming out waving the flag, and he's so ridiculous. But I love heel Jacques Rougeau. I'm a huge mark for heel Jacques Rougeau.
Have you ever seen that promo on YouTube from Canada when he was the Mountie but couldn't call himself the Mountie?
I don't think so.
You know the story behind that, though, right?
Yes.
Where the RCMP wouldn't let him be the Mountie that they threatened to arrest him for impersonating an officer.
And apparently, according to the interview I just saw with Ray Rougeau that Hannibal put up this week, which is tremendous, going over the details of the Dynamite Kid fight with Jacques, I didn't realize that eventually they had succeeded to the point where they forced the World Wrestling Federation to not have him as the Mountie anywhere anymore. And that's why the Mountie went away. And when he came back as a Quebecer, the outfit was modified and the theme song went from I'm the Mountie to We're Not the Mounties. I never realized that's how, you know, that was the way it went down.
Yeah, so anyway, the promo that's on YouTube that I saw, he's, you know, he's not wearing the outfit, and he ends the promo with, I am the Jacques Rougeau.
Okay.
He said, I am the Mounties, I am the Jacques Rougeau.
I'll tell you another one in terms of reactions.
Yeah.
Clash of the Champions in... I'm forgetting the name of the town now in Texas.
Corpus Christi.
The reaction Muda got in the 6-man cage match at the end
when he tags in.
The play, like, that was Muda. That was the only babyface Muda we really got to see in WCW. The place was just popping for everything he did. He was the only guy on that heel team of Buzz Sawyer, the Dragon Master, and Muda that the fans were totally into. So I've always loved that, watching that and just seeing these fans pop for everything Muda did.
Yeah, that's one that I always liked. I mean, they did bring him back in as a babyface a few years later.
Not the same.
No, it wasn't not the same, though. What else? Trying to think as far as things.
I'll give you another one.
Live. Okay.
And I recognize there are major holes in the booking, but still... at the time, I loved it, and in many ways, I feel like it's the epitome of Paul Heyman's ECW, like before the pay-per-view, the first pay-per-view in 97. It was supposed to be Terry Funk against Mr. Hughes. Mr. Hughes gets jumped going to the ring by the Bruise Brothers. Terry Funk doesn't have an opponent. Paul E. comes out and says, I have someone you can fight. Sabu! Before Sabu gets out there, Terry Funk... Terry Funk beats up Paul E. Sabu comes out. They have a great match. Sabu has masked handlers along with 911 around the ring. And they're after the match, one by one, Terry Funk beats them up. And one of them finally gets the upper hand on Terry. And he beats up Terry, goes to the top rope, hits a top rope leg drop, pulls off the mask, and it's beautiful Bobby Eaton. And obviously the leg drop was the Alabama Jam. And the place in ECW goes nuts. They're popping because it's Bobby. All of a sudden... out of nowhere, Arn Anderson comes running in from the back. Now the place just goes completely apeshit to the point where whoever was next to the camera yells, holy shit, it's Arn Anderson! And the whole, I mean, you could just see everyone, Sarge McGee in the front row lifting his arms in the air. He doesn't know what to do. It's one of those really cool moments. And I like the fact that Arn and Bobby had this feud, although it wasn't booked the greatest everywhere, but... started as a tag team in WCW. You can actually trace it back to 88, when the Midnights and the Horsemen feuded, right. It was, you know, him, Arn, and Bobby were supposed to be best friends when they were in real life, but in the angle, they were friends. And then they have that feud, and then they have the program for the TV title in 90 or 91, And then they have they're teamed up. They're a tag team. They win the tag titles. Then they break up and they have a little feud. Then they go to Smoky Mountain Wrestling. The feud continues. And then eventually it ends up in ECW.
Yeah. One unheralded, I guess more of a wrestler in general than a moment that I mark out for is...
Yo Mamba, the Jungle Savage.
Sorry, I had to do that.
Well played, Dix. Well played.
Another ECW one involving Terry Funk, because it used to be one that people talked about, but not really anymore, is his return coming out of the box in 95. Mainly for the moment where everyone realizes it's him when Cactus Jack pulls the towel off his head. Because it's like it's a ripple effect in the crowd opposite the hard camera. You
was
see
that,
one by... What?
Cactus versus DC Drake? Was that
yes.
the map? Okay.
You see row by row the crowd pop when they realize it's Terry Funk.
Yeah.
It's like they're almost like they're doing the wave, like going back towards the back wall of the arena. That it's like the first row pops, and then the second row pops, and then third row pops, and then the bleachers pop. It's like I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like that before. Like even in other smaller buildings where things got hot.
Hey Siri, who is in the box?
Yomamba the Jungle Savage.
Oh, there you go. Yomamba the Jungle Savage.
You got to start trying to type it phonetically to get it to...
I know. Because it came out where Bix lives instead of where Bix lives. Yeah, you know, I'm not crazy about that. I mean, I was actually really big on DC Drake returning, although it ended up just being kind of like, if it wasn't a one-night thing, it was like a two-night thing. Because DC Drake had been a big name on Northeast Independence for many years, the NWF, and even before that as a babyface in like Pennsylvania in like 84, 83. And then, of course, he became like the main local guy for Joel Goodhart for the TWA. And then by the time ECW came around, DC Drake was gone. But I used to read about him in the magazines like DC Drake against JT Smith and all these things. So when he came back, I was actually like, I popped for that. Just the idea that here's this guy who has a history in Philadelphia. And probably should be in ECW, and here he is in ECW. And then he was gone.
Yeah. What else? I'm trying to... One thing that I always... that for some reason stuck with me a lot, even though there's really nothing to the angle, is Eddie Gilbert's debut in Global. Just because I guess because he had been off TV for a little while, and I don't think anyone like new debuted in Global, really, after the first couple months till he did. Does that sound right? That I don't
remember his debut. Was it something like special that
happened?
No,
it wasn't even that special. I just remember it always stuck with me for some reason. It's remember how the Patriot won the North American title finals against Al Perez,
yeah.
But then he wanted to give Al Perez a rematch and vacate the title because Perez's foot was on the ropes, even though Perez was a heel.
Yes.
So then the rematch, Gilbert just comes out. I think – I try to remember if he helps one of them or whatever. But for some – like they made a big deal out of it, and maybe that was just it because it's really nothing as an angle. But for some reason, that always just stuck with me for some reason. I don't know why, but it did.
Eddie Gilbert, one of the great things I remember him booking in Global was – you know, I was a kid. And when you're a kid, you're less tolerant of job guys getting a chance than you are when you're older. And Eddie Gilbert used Barry Horowitz so well in Global that I actually started to like Barry Horowitz.
The winner, Barry Horowitz.
The winner, Barry Horowitz.
selling the videotape winning moments for $59.95.
Are there any comps of just the Eddie booked period of Global?
I don't know, but I'd like to see one.
Yeah, I would really like to see one because I haven't seen a lot of that stuff since it first aired. I'd rush home from school and see it at 4 o'clock on ESPN.
Yeah, best of Eddie Gilbert booking Global. Because he also have the Bruce Pritchard stuff with him. As he, you know,
do you think it's worse? Do you think it's worse to air wrestling every day at 4 p.m. than it is to air it late at night? Like, what time slot do you think is more restrictive?
Well, you're not really going to build a promotion with 4 p.m. weekdays. I mean, but it's not like Global. Global only ran one show outside of Texas in the really when it came down to it. So
yeah, in Atlanta, right?
In it was at the Cobb County Civic Center.
Oh, okay. So
same show as Stephen DeTruth versus the Blue Blazer.
Oh, I just heard that story recently. That's right. Well, Any other moments? We could always return to this, Bix, if nothing else is popping into your head.
I think that's it for right now. Maybe I'll blurt something out later if I think of something else.
You once told me the best match you ever saw live and it was just an experience was Samoa Joe versus Kenta Kobashi.
Well, that's not unheralded, though.
No, but what was your experience there with that?
It was just like it was the closest thing I've ever been to, as far as wrestling-wise, it was like a religious experience. It was just amazing, just the atmosphere, and it was, like, so much of it, too, was with Kobashi, just, like, his presence and his facial expressions and his command of everything, and I think a lot of it was also just that I think people did kind of had resigned themselves to not going into the match with that high expectations. Because I think people realized, well, it's a Japanese wrestler coming to the States for vacation, even though they're booking him against Samoa Joe in the main event. Maybe we shouldn't get our hopes up. And then during the week, you start hearing from like what Kobashi's saying in the Japanese media. And he's like, I want to have the perfect match. It's like, interesting. And if he didn't, he sure damn well tried. I've never seen anything like that. I mean, I've seen great matches live, and other stuff with some, whether Japanese wrestlers or even other guys from NOAH. Like, we saw together live the Bryan Danielson versus Kenta match.
Yeah,
which was
in 96.
Absolutely fantastic. 2006.
2006, excuse me.
And that's probably the second best match I've ever seen live. And also, a couple of years ago when Chikara did those Joshi Mania shows, there was one that it was Aja Kong and two of the younger Japanese women's wrestlers against Manami Toyota and two of the younger Japanese women's wrestlers. That was absolutely incredible, but still nothing like that Kobashi match and seeing him live. It was just – it's hard to put into words almost. I mean, now I kind of want to go back and watch it again too. Just everything, the atmosphere, just the physicality of it. And it was mostly, just safe stuff like chops. And so, except for Joe getting suplexed on his head. But most of the match was, just tops and stuff like that. And also just how loud the chops were. And then the way they'd play off Joe's spots. Like, remember how Joe had the Olay kick where he'd set his opponent in a chair on the floor and then get the fans doing the Olay chant and then run and kick the and soccer kick him?
Of course.
Kobashi did an ole chop to Joe. So it was just everything you would have wanted that match to be. That
Bix
I think
is a slip house boy. Bix is a slip house boy. Bix is a slip house boy.
Siri, how dare you? Naughty girl.
What does that even mean?
Bix is a slip house boy. I don't know. Slip house is the new thing. The definition you had before was hysterical.
Did you ask Siri for a real definition?
No.
I want to know if you get an actual definition.
Hey, Siri. What is a slip house boy?
Checking. Okay, I found this on the web for what is a slip house boy. Take a look.
Yeah,
ask what a slip house is, though.
Siri, what is a slip house?
Checking on that. Okay, I found this on the web for what is a slip house.
Yeah, nothing. Siri's not really giving me much.
So Google Now is better than Siri, clearly.
I guess. I mean, whatever it was that Google Now told you about slip houses in England. Well, we'll have to get some of our British listeners to jump in and inform us.
All right. I'm just still trying to figure this whole thing out. I don't know.
Siri, what is a slip house?
The House of Galeen.
The House of Galeen. All right, there you go. Whoa! Bix! You crafty little devil over there. Larry Nelson. Well, on that note, on that puzzling note, I think we're ready for our next segment here on the show. We've done a few what-if segments and have gotten a really great reaction from everyone, and it's something we'll continue as they pop up. We have one we thought of, but before we get to that, we had one someone wrote in on our Facebook page. As always, please join our community on Facebook. It is facebook.com/superpodcast. And Dean Jackson wrote us in one, Bix. Let me get your thoughts on this.
Mm-hmm.
What would have happened if Shawn Michaels quit the WWF around WrestleMania 9? There were talks about it. Who would have replaced him versus Razor at WrestleMania 10? What would have become of the Click? Would him and Triple H have gotten along in WCW? Would he have been able to pull off the politics with Eric as much as he did with Vince? Who would have stepped up to the plate in HBK's spot from 93 to 95? There's a lot to unpack there. But
I like the question, would he have been able to pull off the politics with Eric Bischoff as much as he could have with Vince? Yes.
Well, well, I mean, here's the thing. I remember hearing Shawn Michaels was thinking about quitting. I guess 93 would be right. I don't remember if it was before WrestleMania 9, but it was definitely that year.
I thought the first story of him quitting was earlier, was before the Rockers split.
Okay, maybe.
Is that story just BS that Jannetty was going to be the heel and Michaels threatened to quit and go to Memphis to prove he could be a heel?
It sounds like bullshit, because who would threaten to leave the WWE to go to Memphis? I don't necessarily buy that. I mean, I remember around that time there was the rumor that Bret Hart was going to go to WCW, but that was legit. There were actually talks there.
Right.
So Shawn Michaels, let's say he goes to WCW in early 93. Early 93 is not very good. I mean, there's the Hollywood Blondes. There's Steamboat. Douglas is about to leave because of whatever his issue was. Tom Zink is still there. Flair doesn't begin wrestling again until the fall, but Arn Anderson's there. Bobby Eaton's there. Sid shows up shortly after that. Vader's the champion. Sting's on top with Vader. I don't know. Where does Shawn Michaels fit into the mix in WCW 93?
Hmm. The thing I'm thinking about as far as with Vader, like if he lets Vader be Vader, it depends on, I guess, well, he doesn't have all of his power yet. But
well,
go ahead.
Do you assume he's a babyface or a heel when he comes in? I'm thinking heel.
I'm just thinking of who he matches up well with. If he comes in as a heel,
I mean, him and Steamboat might be something.
Yes. Sting. Cactus Jack.
Cactus was babyface. That's right before the Cactus Vader angle. Yeah.
Dustin.
That'd be interesting.
Hmm.
Wyndham was already heel by that point.
Scorpio.
Scorpio was in a team with Bagwell, because I got to see them in New York, the only time I ever got to see the Hollywood Blondes live.
Singles. He had the match with Wyndham.
That's right. That was actually a really great match.
Yes.
That was a really, really good
really,
match.
Really good.
Maybe
you know what?
Last,
that's an unheralded Markell moment for me.
Maybe the last great Barry Wyndham match.
I would say so, yes. But it's also like they built such a tremendous match, and suddenly it's like, oh my God, Too Cold Scorpio might win the NWA World title.
Yeah, that was the same show as the Hollywood Blondes versus the Horsemen, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that was one of the last great clashes, too.
Yeah, what would be the last great clash? Because none of the other 93 ones were good. 94.
Well, which one in 94 had Steamboat versus Austin? Because I always thought that was
the August one. The one that had Flair and Hogan. That's a very good clash. That's a good one.
Yeah.
And then
Now we say, you know, here comes Hogan in 94. Does Shawn Michaels just get lost in the mix like Steve Austin did?
I'm trying to, unless Hogan would like, well, no, Hogan would think he's too small, because I was going to say, would Hogan like that he could pinball for him, but my gut says Hogan thinks he's too small or something.
Yeah, I would guarantee that.
But in 93, he's got a lot of good baby faces that he can work with.
Yeah. And then, you know, another part of this question was who would have taken his place in the WWF for those years from 93 to 95? There really isn't anyone in terms of being the same as a young, up and coming heel. There are other heels they could have slotted in there. It wouldn't have been as good, you know, if they put Rick Martel in the same position on the show as Shawn Michaels was. No disrespect, because I like Rick Martel, but it wouldn't have been the same.
Right. Or even someone like Bigelow. Right.
Yeah. You know who would have been interesting in kind of that role, although he probably wouldn't have fit that spot as well, but that role is that kind of heel in 93? Brian Christopher.
Yes.
It would have been perfect.
And there were always rumors that he'd be coming in, too.
Yeah.
And he did work that show at the Garden. And did he work any other house shows besides that?
I don't remember. You know, I know I told the story once before on the show that I got to see Jeff Jarrett in 92, maybe the first WWF match he had outside of Memphis, at the Meadowlands in like early October 1992. Another thing I remember about that show, it just came back to me the other day. I don't know why I was thinking about it. Terry Taylor made his return on that show.
Terrific Terry Taylor.
Terrific Terry Taylor. And he gets in the ring, and not to anyone in particular, but just out loud, like not even loudly, but just like he says it out loud with all the arrogance in the world, he goes, "I'm back." And as soon as he said that, someone went, "Ah!" like 2 seconds, he had that moment, and then the rooster call started coming from the crowd. And I'll never get to the ring. She's like, "I'm back," and I was like, "Who's he saying that to?" Well, Dean, hopefully we answered some of your Shawn Michaels. If he would have quit around that time, what if? The second what if we have right here, we're gonna have a special guest on in a moment to discuss this with us. I was watching the other day, I was going through Bix some old Mid-South house shows because there's so many great matches on there. And the Sam Houston Coliseum, I'm such a mark for really good, exciting matches from there. And the match was the Midnight Express with Jim Cornette from April of 1984 against Bill Dundee and Porkchop Cash, a weird tag team if there ever was one. Well, the reason it was Bill Dundee, the booker, his first match, I believe, in Mid-South, and Porkchop Cash was because the Dream Machine, Troy Graham, Porkchop Cash's partner, had broken his ankle, as we were about to find out, shortly, like the week before they were going to come in, because it was going to be the Bruise Brothers from Memphis, and it never happened. So it got me thinking, what if the Dream Machine actually had a run in Mid-South? What do you think, Bix?
Especially, I think they would have fit in well as babyfaces there. And we never really got to see those two team as babyfaces. We saw Porkchop and Mad Dog Boyd as babyfaces, and that was interesting. But
but it's not the same just because, you know, the Dream Machine could do those promos. He could do those local promos. And imagine if they worked with the
Midnight Express. Well, yeah, yeah. I know.
Imagine him and Cornette going back and forth on local promos.
Right. I'm curious how they would have been as a babyface tag team. I mean, in the ring, they were a very underrated team. Like, you've seen the matches they had with the Rock and Roll Express, right?
Yeah, those are fun.
Memphis. Yeah, they had really good matches. Probably the best Porkchop Cash matches I've seen. And I'm curious how they would have done as baby faces. And, I think they could have done very well. I think they would have gotten over very well there as baby faces. I mean, who else? And also, they could have, besides the Midnights, who they probably would have had great matches with, who else was around that they maybe could have worked with?
That's the thing. Midnight were the big heel team, and they worked with everyone that came in. It was Rock and Roll, the Fantastic,
right.
PYT. Before that, it was TA and Magnum. By this point, Butch Reed and Neidhart are no longer a team.
That's what I was just going to ask.
Well, actually, I guess around that time, if they weren't working Midnights, Mr. Wrestling 1 and 2, you know, Mr. Wrestling 2 became Mr. Wrestling 1, and Mr. Wrestling 3 became Mr. Wrestling 2, Hercules Hernandez. So they were still teaming around this time.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have been an option. And, you know, just like – or they could have just done like a Mid-South makeshift tag team of like Ernie Ladd and, you know, whoever.
Right. Who else was around his heel? Butch Reed was still a heel, right?
Butch Reed was definitely still a heel. Buddy Landell was there as Butch Reed's little sidekick.
Oh, so Butch Reed and Buddy Landell. There you go.
Buddy Landell. Now, here's the other exciting thing. If they would have gotten in there, I agree with you. I think because of the strength of the promos of Troy Graham, the Dream Machine, they would have gotten over big. But then when they turned heel, his promos would have been able to make them major heels, or at least him.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they, you know, I'm trying to think if I've ever really seen promos from them during the Bruise Brothers era, though.
In Memphis, you didn't see it. Well, Jimmy Hart was their manager, so it kind of took away a lot of the promo time for the Dream Machine.
That's the thing. As the New York Dolls, did he do any promos either?
Yeah, off the top of my head, I don't remember. That's a great question. New York Dolls, for those of you who don't know, or Troy Dream Machine Grand and Rick McGraw, Quick Draw Rick McGraw, Bleach Blonde. See, that's what's always so weird. Here's the Dream Machine, who was a big star in Memphis for a while in like 81. And then they bring him back with the New York Dolls and he's just kind of buried in this tag team.
And they did acknowledge that he was the same guy because they would call him Dream Machine Troy Graham sometimes.
Yeah.
Did he lose a mask match or I try to remember?
I don't remember if he lost a mask, man. He was a baby face, and then he turned heel and had that great run with Lawler, some of the great promos of that era.
And then I think he turned face again.
And then he was gone. I mean, how long was he gone before he became a New York Doll in 82?
I'm not sure. And what a transformation, too, because like, as I think it was maybe my friend Phil Snyder put it, he sure was roided up for a guy who used to do a fake Dusty gimmick.
I never thought of it that way, but.
New York Dolls were a good tag team, too.
Yeah, I mean, Jim Cornette explained it when I asked him about it on his show a couple weeks ago that, you know, the original plan was the Fabulous Ones were going to be brought in to go against the New York Dolls, run them off, and then the Fabulous Ones were going to turn heel with Cornette as their manager turning against Jackie Fargo, right. Which, of course, they got over too well. It wouldn't work. They couldn't turn down all the merchandise sales and blowjobs, I would assume, also. So the heel turn never happened. Come on, it's Memphis. You know it's the truth. You know? So, yeah, but when Bix and I started talking about this, I figured this would be a cool topic. And then when I recorded the Jim Cornette show this week, I brought up, you know, just what's on our show this week. I brought up this topic and Jim popped and said he had some stuff to say. So Bix and I spoke to Jim Cornette just a little while ago. And here are his thoughts on the big what if. What if the Dream Machine had gone to Mid-South Wrestling in early 1984? Okay, we're back with another one of our popular What If segments. Last time, the What If Roddy Piper had gone to Dallas in 82, accepting Gary Hart's offer, was very popular, so we decided to try this again. And this one comes because I was watching some old Mid-South house shows the other day, and I saw a match that stood out between the Midnight Express, managed by Jim Cornette, against Bill Dundee and Porkchop Cash. Now, it was supposed to be the Bruise Brothers of Porkchop Cash and Troy Dream Machine Graham. Unfortunately, there was a broken leg, which not only prevented Troy Graham from coming in, but also prevented the Bruise Brothers from getting a run in Mid-South Wrestling. So we figured no one better to talk to about this than Jim Cornette himself. Jim, how you doing today?
Well, I'm good, and I'm making a cameo on the show because I'm about to rush out, as you know, to leave for the latest installment of the Spring Fling Tour. But when I heard you were talking about the Dream Machine, I had to get involved because he was a good friend of mine. He was one of the first guys when I was still a photographer that I actually he talked to me, you know, like I was smart. And I'm not talking about intelligent. I'm talking about smart to the business. It was at a time then where you didn't admit that in a lot of cases. You didn't know whether you might get run off or not. But Dream figured out I knew what was going on. And he's one of the first people who actually said to me, you know something, Jim, you're going to be a manager one of these or a booker one of these days. And I wasn't even a manager yet. And so I'm just a photographer. And I'm like, I think he's crazy. But it turned out he was crazy as a fox, and he was a great talent. So I'm happy to lend my expertise in this subject matter.
Wait, so is a Dream Machine impression actually any different from a Dusty impression?
It is a little. Dusty had a little more of this stuff to him, whereas Dream just kind of talked a little more, just kind of like that. and see, the thing is, Troy. He grew up when Dusty started appealing to all the black fans. Troy grew up very poor, and he was poor most of his life. Didn't have a lot. Lived in a lot of black neighborhoods. He said one time in a later interview when he came back to Memphis in the early 90s for just a short run after he'd had some troubles. He said, "Hey, I'm a guy. I hang out in places where people get cut and shot," and that was pretty much true. He would tell you. You know, he had problems sometimes with taking pills when he shouldn't be and doing things that he shouldn't do. And he always liked to stay around home. And we'll get into this. But I wanted to see the Bruise Brothers, Dream Machine and Porkchop, get a run in Mid-South Wrestling because Dream was such a great promo. And he was a great worker. He wasn't a great athlete, but he was a great worker. And he could do stuff, especially at his size. That, you know, that got to match over and his shit looked good, but his promos were just off the charts and they were ahead of what most people were doing back in those days. So I wanted to see them get that shot. And, but I don't know in retrospect, thinking about it, since you brought it up, how long it would have lasted. Cause Dream always liked to stay close to home. He liked to stay close to Memphis and he was on top in the Knoxville territory for a while. He learned a lot of what he knew about wrestling in the Mississippi territory, working for Frankie Kane, the great Mephisto, who he idolized as a great booker and a great wrestling mind. He was Troy T. Tyler every once in a while. He was he had a couple of other names, but he really had his best run in Memphis, and since that's where he's from, I think that's what he tried to make that his homestead.
Now, you know, it's really we really missed out on a lot not having any Dream Machine localized promos with Reese or Bowden. That would have really been one of the great things ever.
Oh, my God. Because, you know, the Dream Machine, he is that man that walked that barbed wire fence 32,000 miles barefooted, eat steel wool like cake, stopped lightning with bread, picked up Lou Gehrig, caught 9,000 buckshot from Maine to Spain on a choo-choo train. You know, his shit was great. I was born in the heat of the desert. My mama died giving me life, the pride and the love of a father blamed for the loss of his wife. You understand what I'm saying? Brian Last, just because your breath smells like cheetahs ain't no sign that you're Tarzan. You know, could rattle it off. He really looked up to Tom Boogaloo Shaft, who was this old black guy in the 60s and 70s in the southern territories, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, that had that fucking patter and that bullshit. And he researched a lot of that. But it was just – it was different in that day. And people, you know, they gravitated to it.
You know, you asked the difference between a Dream Machine and a Dusty Rhodes promo, Bix. I think Dream Machine was faster.
Yes.
He spit out more stuff faster than Dusty ever did.
Yes.
Well, you know, so around this time, you know, you guys wrestled at the Sam Houston Coliseum on April 6th, you and the Express against Dundee and Porkchop.
Managed by Jimmy Hart, by the way. He came to my backyard where I was the star after I'd been his flunky and you know, second fiddle for so long. So that was fun.
Well, Dundee was the booker. Was that the first time he actually wrestled in the Mid-South Territory, although it was Houston? But while he was booking, was that the first match he had?
Yes, because Watts didn't want him to wrestle. He didn't want the booker to wrestle. And Dundee always wanted to wrestle because he loved it. And so in that case, since basically the injury happened, I think the week that they were supposed to come down and start, the series of matches. And I'm pretty sure that Dundee just went to Watts and said, geez, I'll take his place because we got nobody else. And Watts said, okay, go ahead. And it wasn't – Dundee was a great wrestler, but Watts just wanted the separation of church and state, so to speak, back then, office and ring. And booking that territory was job enough, but Dundee was always a workaholic. But the team of Dundee and Porkchop Cash did not have the same cachet, as they say, as the Bruise Brothers did.
Well, this is the show before the last Stampede in Houston and right before you really got going with the rock and roll. Was the plan for a Midnight Express Bruise Brothers program?
You know, I don't know. I don't know if it got that far. I think that just because they were big events and big shows that Watts wanted to bring some new talent in and some different talent. And also they were always looking for, either tags or singles, especially in the wake of Junkyard Dog leaving, that would appeal to the black audience in Mid-South. And definitely, because I'll tell you, Dream was blacker than Porkchop. So I think they would have been a big hit down there and probably maybe have taken the spot that later on Norvell Austin and Coco Ware had later that year as the PYTs. I don't know if there was a big angle or big program planned with us, but it probably would have happened if both teams had been in the same territory at the same time, because we did do a run with pretty much every team there. And I got to correct you one thing. It wasn't a broken leg. It was a broken ankle. He was doing that baseball slide spot out under the rope, and his foot got caught on the ring apron that was, you know, that has a cable that's stretched tight from post to post to keep the ring apron skirt on, and it got caught in that and just snapped his ankle, and it was a bad break.
Ooh,
and and that's actually because I still kept up, even though we weren't there, I still kept up with the Memphis TVs. And when they brought Dream back as a manager of Roger Smith and Donnie Bass, who were the interns this time, not the assassins or whatever, but
Fire and Flame.
They were the interns this time, even though they were wearing the same outfits, not the white intern outfits, but the same outfits. But they had Dream in a wheelchair because everybody knew he'd gotten hurt as their manager. And that was obviously not the first time that's happened. That's an old saw in wrestling, the manager in the wheelchair. But that's where I got the inspiration for later on, 8 years later, or whatever it was, Ron Wright.
Wow.
Well, you know, you brought up Dream Machine's return in 1994 in Memphis. The Bruce Brothers, a different variation of them with Porkchop Cash and Mad Dog Boyd, would get a run in Mid-South Wrestling a year later, culminating with them stealing Eddie Gilbert's portrait. And Dream Machine would return to Memphis in 1994. I'm curious, when you, a friend of Troy Graham, someone who was a fan of the Dream Machine, when you see that he's back in Memphis and he's cutting amazing promos, even though he'd been gone for so many years, did you at all consider bringing him into Smoky Mountain?
You know, actually, he was I was so immersed, I think he was back and gone again before I knew that he had come back. to be quite honest. But also at that point in time, you know, did he even work the rest of the Memphis territory? Did he even come to Louisville? I think he just worked Memphis. I may be wrong. I never have been before. But it was a short thing, and I'm not sure, you know, Dream had a lot of other issues going on at that time in his life. I'm not sure that it would have worked out for the best. I prefer to remember him as he was, so to speak. And also, Porkchop and Mad Dog, by the way, were the original Bruce Brothers. You don't know this, but the original Bruce Brothers were going to be Porkchop Cash and Iceman King Parsons.
Wow.
Really?
And they were supposed to start on Memphis TV, but and this was back in 1983, but when you know who won the pony, Porkchop showed up, but King Parsons took a spot in Dallas. And
wow.
Went there instead. So at Memphis TV, Porkchop's there, and they've got two Bruce Brothers outfits. And there'd been this guy that had been hanging around in the back parking lot of Channel 5 for weeks and months. Desperate to get in the wrestling business. He'd been wrestling outlaw shows down in Mississippi, and he swore that he could do it. And I think Lawler sent Jimmy Hart out to say, does he fit the coat? And there was Mad Dog Boyd. And he fit the coat, and they brought him in into the studio. They didn't bring him in the territory. They actually brought him in the studio from the parking lot. I think it was the first week or two. I mean, his work, and his body, But they gave him a chance to cut a promo where Porkchop, Jimmy Hart had introduced him, whatever, and Porkchop said something, and then Mad Dog is supposed to say something, and what he said was, I'm so bad I eat Popeye. Did he just say he's so bad he eats Popeye? And everybody said, we think he did, King. So when he comes back, Lawler asked him, said, why did you say you're so bad you eat Popeye? And Mad Dog said, no, King, you don't understand. I said, I'm so bad, I eat Popeye. Yes, you eat Popeye. No, he was saying barbed wire. But because of his accent and the way he talked, it sounded like he said he eat pie. But no, he's so bad he eats barbed wire. And he didn't say a lot more after that. So then basically, as soon as they could find somebody else, and that was Dream Machine, Mad Dog got moved out of the Bruce Brothers and Dream Machine got moved in. And then later on, when Dream was hurt, I guess Mad Dog had gotten better or standards had lowered.
Well, I know you have limited time, so I just want to ask you a couple more things about the Dream Machine before we let you go. You were in Mid-South already in 1984 when one of the most memorable things on Memphis TV in that era happened, which was the death of the Bruce Brothers.
Yeah.
Do you remember when you first saw that?
I was actually going to ask you the same thing.
Probably a couple weeks later, because I would get the tapes. Norm Dooley, my old bosom buddy from Louisville, would send me the Louisville shows on tape. And, you know, he'd wait until it was like a month's worth and fill up the tape or whatever. So it was a few weeks afterwards. But it was, you know, it was one of those things that you could only get away with on Memphis TV. You couldn't do it anywhere else.
A funeral with Joe LaDuke, followed by the Bruce Brothers dressed as the Fabulous Ones doing a mirror image of a Fabulous Ones video with all the dancing around together and the tuxedos. It's one of the funniest
and
things.
Jimmy Hart going, ding, 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 ding.
Well, the other thing I wanted to mention is pre-Bruce Brothers, one of the few times in Memphis that I can remember where Lance Russell actually got an altercation and took a bump when after – I believe it was the week after Jerry Lawler had tarred and feathered the Dream Machine.
Yes.
They played a video to Alley Oop of the Dream Machine.
By the Hollywood Argyles.
And written by Kim Fowley. And
really?
Yes. And it upset – the Dream Machine to the point where he ran out and not tackled, but grabbed Lance Russell, who went down immediately. And It's one of those times on Memphis TV where he grabbed the mic, and even though he wears a mask and he talks in that lisp, and you would think that would make him unbelievable, he's completely believable when he yells, "Lawler, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you, Jerry Lawler."
It was believable because they made two videos. They made the one set to like Superman theme or some glorious uplifting music of Lawler just beating everybody in the world, destroying everybody from Hulk Hogan on down, winning all his matches, getting his hand in the air, and then here comes Alley-Oop, Oop, Oop. They're the man in the funny paper that we all know, and it's Dream Machine. And at one point, he was big. He was heavy. He was almost 300 pounds when he first came in to work with Lawler, still doing the upside-down button, the turnbuckle and everything. But then over a period of time, he got on a conditioning program, probably the only time in his life he was taking care of himself, and he lost a lot of weight and was moving good, but they showed all these clips of him like doing a guy did a drop down spot in front of him and he tripped on the guy or fallen down or stuff that was worked in the match to make him look foolish. Right. But they combined it with a few, unintended slip ups, and it lit Dream up a little bit. And when he went out there, he was just going to snatch Lance by the collar, but he was moving so fast, he was so fired up, and he was so big anyway, when he snatched Lance, it just knocked him over backwards. And that was a no-no in Memphis. That got over because nobody touched Lance in those days, and wasn't supposed to then, but Lance wasn't upset about it, and he got by with it. But yeah, that alley-oop thing, he brought that up to me in the car. So I used to Dream lived in Memphis, and I still lived in Louisville when I was a photographer, and then when I first became a manager, it was like 6 months before I moved to Nashville, so that's 400 miles apart. And we were in Memphis every Monday night and Louisville every Tuesday. So since Dream stayed up all night for whatever reason, and I wanted to go home, he would ride with me from Memphis. We'd meet at the Shoney's on Summer Avenue. He'd leave his car, and we'd make the whole trip and get in at like 6 o'clock in the morning. I'd drop him off at the Days Inn in Jeffersonville where he could check in on a new day, and I'd go home and get some sleep at my mom's house. And those trips were not only some of the most informative, but just some of the funniest that I ever took, because your face would hurt from laughing if you spent any time around Troy Graham. He was just fucking hilarious in any situation, and he could tell stories like crazy. So that was one of my first educations, when he would talk to me about Frankie Kane and his his style of booking, or what he felt, got over, and just how, he had done different things in his career. And it was, there were some great trips. I wish I had some of them on tape. We didn't have tape back then.
To bring this full circle, what's really strange is that of all the people that Watts brought in to try to replace JYD, you don't want to have anyone that's just like it, but they were too different. None of them had, besides that most of them weren't that good anyway.
I was about to say, besides the fact that most of them were the shits.
Yeah, except for Reed, most of them weren't that good, and he was already there. He just got the push. Yeah. They didn't have the speaking ability or anything. They didn't have the rep. And then, bringing in the Bruise Brothers, he brought them in before JYD left.
True. That's
right. I mean, so the one act that he brings in that actually has the promo ability and all that, he brought them in before JYD left.
Well, but it at the same time, they were not going to replace JYD.
No, but I mean, still though, in terms of appealing to the black fans with that type of persona and all that, I think that's a kind of an interesting footnote to all that.
And boy, some of the things that I got away with saying back in those days, I can't repeat them now on the air, or I'd be accused of being a racist. But they told me one time, Porkchop said, "Yeah, say this, the Porkchop Cash, you got a nose so big I could flip quarters in it from 25 feet." He loved shit like that. And so, all the guys, they loved the stiff insults and things. I'm going to read you Roots backwards so it's got a happy ending. That got heat, and the boys loved it, and nobody got insulted or kicked off the air. It was a simpler time back then.
And there was also that one promo that Lawler would do, even as a babyface in Memphis, and Dream Machine would do, or I think it might have been as Troy Tyler, the whole thing where it's like, well, I can't blacken your eye. I can't flatten your nose. I can't give you a
black eye and a fat lip, Coco.
Yeah, that whole thing.
That's what he used to say. Yeah. And actually, when he was a babyface, Lawler was, when he was a heel, the first the first group of fans to take to Lawler were the black fans, and they loved him, and they would cheer like crazy for him. And then when he became a babyface and everybody liked him, the black fans liked him more often than not, more than the white fans, and he could still get by with knocking the black heels. Because once again, it was a situation. It was babyface and heel. Anything the babyface says is right. Anything the heel says, when somebody would slip and cuss, if it was a babyface, you were fine. They could get away with anything. You wouldn't get one phone call. But Gorgeous George Jr. slipped one time on live TV and called Dundee a chicken shit worm, and oh my God, they took him off TV for weeks.
All right. Well, in closing, Jim, how would you like to see the Dream Machine remembered?
I would just like to see the Dream Machine remembered, to be honest with you, because so many people outside of Memphis didn't know about him to begin with, and so many people may have forgotten about him. Of course, he passed away. Gosh, it's been quite a while. You probably have it there in front of you, Brian. You're so prepared. But
I think it's 2002.
Yeah, it's been like 15 years, and I'm sure that was hastened by some of the out-of-the-ring habits that he had. But I would just like people to remember the Dream. So, if you can, go to YouTube and just look up the Dream Machine in Memphis, promos, matches, whatever. He was different. He was different than everybody else, and he loved the wrestling business. He was born for the wrestling business. As a matter of fact, he would – at the Days Inn in Jeffersonville, I'll tell you this story and I'm going to get off here, where all the guys used to stay, the Days Inn had a gimmick where they would have not only a Bible in the room, but also they would have a thing sitting on the TV saying, our Days Inn pastor is so-and-so. If you have any problems, if you need help, you can call him at this number. And it would actually, it was a local pastor, and they would give his home number, right? So fucking Dream checks in at 6 o'clock one morning. And he's peeled up, and I mean, he used to practice sometimes doing blade jobs in the mirror in the hotel room, whatever fucking reason. And that day he decided, he calls this guy at like 6:30 in the morning on a Tuesday morning, and he calls the pastor, and the guy says, "Hello? Preacher, I need help. What, son, what do you know what time it is? I don't care what time it is, preacher. I need help. But it's 6:30 in the morning, but I need help now." And the guy hung up on him. So apparently the preacher was only a man of God between the hours of 9 and 5 or whatever. But anything could happen when Troy Graham was around.
So there it is. Jim had some interesting perspectives on an interesting perspective on the what if the Dream Machine had gone to Mid-South. Bix, you and I are both major Dream Machine fans. I'm glad that we were able to talk to Jim, not just about him in Mid-South, but just a general overall talk about the Dream Machine.
Yeah, and talking about him as Troy T. Tyler, and even when he came back a little and all that. I mean, I'm trying to think, what was my favorite part? I liked the stuff where he explained, talked about the different, what's the best word to put it? His different, like, favorite lines to use in promos and stuff like that. And just the way he was able to explain, like, the rap he had, and then I think it was you that chimed in with the whole thing about the speed of it compared to Dusty. He was not just a Dusty ripoff, even though someone might think of it that way. He made it unique. Like, like Jim mentioned, something I had read before was that Dream Machine had taken a lot from Tom Boogaloo Shaft, too. And that it was really, it was not even that I think that he was trying to be like Dusty Rhodes as much as he did, for lack of a better term, the same jive promo style. And then I think as Troy T. Tyler, at least, and then Dream Machine, because of the name, he might have gotten played up a little bit more. But he's not just some straight-up Dusty ripoff.
No.
And no one should think of him that way.
If you want a Dusty ripoff in Memphis, see Dirty Rhodes. There's your Dusty ripoff.
Roger Smith is Dirty Rhodes.
Yeah. No, Dream Machine was tremendous, and it was like a revelation when I first started getting tapes and I saw him. I'm like, who is this guy? He's amazing. And then when he came back in 94, he looked a lot, obviously he looked older, but he looked a lot, a lot more grizzled.
yes, to say the least.
What did you get to see a lot of that stuff in 94 when he returned?
I haven't seen as much as I'd like. I do have some of it, though. I should get to watching it more. Have you ever seen the match he had with Lawler that's on one of the Lawler home videos, the Coward's Way Out match?
No. No.
It's really fun. It's just the loser is whoever flees the ring in terror after... After the other wrestler gets the upper hand somehow. So, of course, Lawler hits him with a fireball, and he runs to the back, and that's the end. And there's no referee.
Is the story that Lawler learned the fireball from the Sheik? Like, not like the real story, but the kayfabe story. Was it that, like, when he wrestled the Sheik, he learned the fireball, and that's why he used it for all those years?
I have no idea. Is that it?
Because he wrestled the Sheik, and the Sheik had the fireball, and I don't remember Lawler doing a fireball before then. So was it supposed to be that he learned it from the Sheik? And then if that's the case, where did Eddie, in storyline, where did Eddie get the fireball from?
I don't think he learned it. I think he just did it because he was hot stuff.
Oh, so obviously the laws of physics, hot stuff means that fire just disseminates from your hands.
No, it means you use slash paper.
Oh, man.
You know who would know the answer to that question, though,
about the guest we just had on the show?
Yes, Jim Cornette. And speaking of Jim Cornette, it's time for our book of the week.
Well, I did want to say one more thing, Bix.
Okay. I wanted to see if I could get that segue in. But
Dream Machine.
Thanks for stomping all over it.
Yeah, well, you know.
Like it was on fire.
When the Dream Machine was there in 94, was he there before the Monday Night Memories show, or did he come back at Monday Night Memories and stay on for
I think it was before Monday Night Memories. Okay, I might be wrong.
I was trying to, in my own mind, figure that out. But sorry to stomp all over your thing. Let's do it again. Let's hold on. Let me see. Maybe Siri will be able to answer this. Siri? Hold on. I have to type in my answer. hey, Siri, who would know about the Dream Machine?
David Bixenspan.
Oh, David Bixenspan. So Siri didn't get it right.
Okay.
But anyway, book of the week.
Book of the week. You start then? Or should I continue?
It's a
from
book
where
by,
I would have gone with my segue.
It's a book by David Bixenham.
Bixenham. That's kosher.
That's your new alias. David Bixenham.
I prefer David Kaleidoscope.
David Kaleidoscope's Slip House Boys. The tales of a young lonely boy in the slip house all alone. No, book of the week is Jim Cornette and his, what's the exact name of the book?
It's called Rags, Paper, and Pins. The subtitle, I believe, is the merchandise of merchandising of Memphis Wrestling.
The merchandise of Mexico, did you say?
No, I said Memphis Wrestling.
The merchandising of Memphis Wrestling. But it's bigger than that, Bix. It's also the story of him as a young fan getting into Memphis Wrestling.
Yeah, so it goes from there. Well, because his role was as photographer, and he ended up, you know, working with the wrestlers at their gimmick tables and selling his photos and working on the programs and all that. So it ties into his journey, too. So it covers that, but it also ties into how Memphis was the first territory to really merchandise the wrestlers.
Yeah. You know, and... Yeah, I see things every now and then pop up. Like, you know, someone posted the other day on Twitter, like Rocky Johnson in his first WWF shirt. You know, so they started really doing mass merchandise in 83. But Memphis was doing it way back. Look, we played The Wrestler's Prayer last week, the Len Rossi song. I mean, Len Rossi and Sputnik Monroe and Jackie Fargo, these guys all had records for sale starting in the 60s.
Yeah, and they had literally pins. You know, they would get little buttons made. For the wrestlers, they had the photos, they had programs. I mean, a lot of places had programs, but in the Tennessee territories, not just Memphis, the gimmick table, you know, especially if you were a babyface, was a big part of your income.
Yeah, very big part of your income. And, you know, those programs are really great. A lot of them are in Jerry Lawler's handwriting, and you realize that Jerry Lawler doesn't know how to spell whenever you see those programs because he misspells.
Right, all of
those.
The, like, bubble lettering and stuff on the covers is him.
Yeah, it's great lettering. It's just he spells every word wrong.
But yeah, it covers, you know, Jim's journey, you know, breaking in with Memphis a photographer. He did kind of become the photographer. Yeah. Then, you know, but it also profiles, all this stuff, the records, the shirts. I mean, all sorts of different stuff. I'm sure there's a ton of
what's really one of the cool things in there, Bix, is that he reprints the old Championship Wrestling magazines. That
yes,
he
I was just going to say that
for Norm Keitzer, and those are really neat to see. And that's really
well. I think it was actually Norm Keitzer printed them for him to sell at the Memphis shows.
Right, but they're Norm, as far as I'm concerned, they're Norm Keitzer magazines. Norm Keitzer set the whole thing up. It's just Jim wrote all the articles and did the pictures. And there are ads.
Well, yeah, he did the printing and the what's the word I'm looking for, typesetting and all that.
Yeah, it's a Norm Keitzer magazine.
So it's got that in there, and yeah, if you want to kind of have a guide to look for the different Memphis related records and stuff, that's a good place to start. I personally have a copy of We Hate School, Jimmy Hart's 45 on a 45 on the 7-inch single that I really, really, really want to eventually get a copy of Lance Russell's Nose, though. The song, the record for the song, not a copy of Lance's actual nose.
Yeah, Scott Cornish, a friend of the show, actually hit me up recently and told me he completed a trade with Jim Cornette. He traded him. He got from Cornette the Ballad of Handsome Jimmy by Jimmy Hart and the Gentrys. And in return, he traded Cornette a record of Wild Thing by the Idolaters, which I guess would be Heartthrob by the Idolaters, which I'm jealous.
Yes,
of.
which is on Amazon. You can get an MP3 from what's the name of the guy? Daryl Rhodes.
Yes.
We should put a link to that up through our Amazon thing, which is yes. If you're gonna get our book of the week, go through our Amazon link. We'll have one specifically for the book in the post for the show notes. But if you're buying anything at Amazon, it doesn't cost any extra money. We just get a little bit of a kickback from Amazon. It's tinyurl.com/605Amazon. And yeah, just whenever you use Amazon, please use that link, and we get a little bit of extra pocket change from them.
Yeah, and just always remember, I know other shows do this, but Steve Austin and Jim Ross and Chris Jericho don't need that. It would help us out. You know, we got families to feed, and they're millionaires. So there you go. And with what, Bix? You got something to say?
No, I started looking on eBay for Jimmy Hart records, and the search didn't work that well. And I actually, I my brain melded two different entries together. I saw something for Jimmy and Doug Rainey above the Gentrys, and for a second I thought it said there was an album by Jimmy and Doug Gentry.
Okay, that would be interesting. All right, well, moving right along with that interesting segue, it is now time.
That wasn't actually a segue.
It is now time. Go ride a segue off a cliff.
Oh, wow. There's a goal.
That's how the guy who owned Segway died. Do you know that?
What?
He rode a Segway off a cliff. Legit.
Did that really happen?
That really happened. Not the guy who created Segway, but the guy who bought the company and owned it, was riding a Segway one day. For some reason, he was near the cliff's edge. And he went off a cliff and he died. It's 100% true.
Some European eBay seller is selling a gold record of Piledriver, the wrestling album, too. It says Canada with a K, so I guess it went gold in Canada, and Canada in German is spelled with a K. But yes, for $488.57 with the exchange rate, you can get the gold record of Piledriver, the wrestling album, too.
Yeah, don't buy that. It's the message I'll send to the listeners. But now it's time for our popular weekly segment, the Dennis of the Week. This may be one of the funniest ones, if not the funniest one we've recorded, Bix.
Yes, we are joined by our mutual old friend, Dave Prazak. And the story that you specifically wanted him to tell, although we get into a lot of other things, is what happened when Dennis Corluzzo and the NWA New Jersey cast of characters invaded Ian Rotten's IWA Mid-South in the Louisville, Kentucky area.
Yeah, this was something I remembered, something I was invited to go to and I didn't, and I regret not going. It is hysterical, just an amazing story, and I have a something to add to this after we're done with this segment. So let's now play Dave Prazak, the owner, operator, promoter of Shimmer Wrestling, talking about Dennis Carluzzo. Today, for the Dennis of the Week, we're joined by an old friend of mine, a friend of Bix. I was about to say, a friend of Bix's, too. Little.
And you are my friends.
Also, one of the very few people I can say is a former broadcast partner of mine, and that's Dave Prazak. Dave, how are you today?
What's going on? I'm doing quite all right, sort of. I tend to hate wrestling currently, but I like talking about old wrestling and when I first broke in, and that is where my Dennis Coraluzzo knowledge comes from.
Well, how did you first meet Dennis?
First time I met Dennis Coraluzzo was the day that I started working for him, which was the first Eddie Gilbert Memorial show. But I knew of Dennis and I kind of corresponded with Dennis, sort of, prior to that, just as a wrestling fan. I was a newsletter writer in high school and I had a cable access show. And, I guess it was more interacting with Mark Coraluzzo, his son, on the internet, that kind of introduced who I was and that I was interested in ring announcing. Cause I think Mark technically said, just like yelled across the house, "Hey dad, Prazak wants to ring announce. Can he?" "Yes." "Okay." And I think that was how I got booked. talking to Mark Coraluzzo on Prodigy or something like that. The first time I met him was the 96 Gilbert Memorial, where he allowed me to co-ring announce the show with Rich Palladino, who I'm sure was not very pleased because he didn't know that he had a second ring announcer who'd never done it before that he had to split this fairly noteworthy show with. But hey, I wasn't going to say no when it was offered to me, so I did it. But I was, as a newsletter writer, I used to comp all of the promoters that I had addresses for in my kayfabe phone directory and address book. I used to send comp issues to, everybody in wrestling that I knew of that I knew was a sheet reader type person. Like, I'd send it to Cornette, I'd send it to Brian Hildebrand, I'd send it to Candido, and I'd send them to Dennis. So since I was sending him newsletter stuff since like 92-ish, I would also be on the mailing list for all of the NWA Championship Wrestling America press releases that Paul Adamovic would write up and send out. So I was always being told what was going on these shows, either through the mail or online or reading the Observer and just looking at the here and there section. And I was a big Smoky Mountain wrestling fan. And, he was the one guy that would bring Smoky Mountain guys to the Northeast. And, he'd go down and do some stuff at Smoky Mountain as a heel character as well, like he did in Memphis. So I kind of, even though I was also an ECW fan, and there used to be a big NWA versus ECW, you can't be a fan of both. I was a fan of both because I liked, I liked Smoky Mountain. I liked Candido. I liked Cornette, And so, therefore, I was a big fan of Dennis Coraluzzo before I ever met him. So I'd try to online in my own little way, in my pocket of suburban Chicago, Illinois, I would try to type up stuff to promote what was upcoming on the Northeast coast for Dennis Coraluzzo shows, before I ever worked for him. So it was just a natural progression that eventually I start going to the shows and doing something on the shows, and that was ring announcing.
You mentioned the 96 Eddie Gilbert Memorial show. That was the weekend of the blizzard of 96. Did you have any trouble getting in for the show?
All I remember was I rode to the show with Allie and her brother Chris Wilcox and probably Mike Grimaldi. I don't remember exactly who was in the car, but probably that was probably the group. They were all there. And I remember walking through snow from the car I don't remember having much trouble myself because I probably flew right in and then they probably picked me up from the airport. We went straight there to the building. I do remember snow being on the ground, but I don't remember having much difficulty myself because, I flew. So I probably wasn't I wasn't driving myself, my own car, to get to the show. So,
and, how did that first Night of Ring Announce and Go For You, and how would you categorize your early experiences with Dennis?
It was absolutely terrible. I had a suit that didn't fit, and I remember I had white socks on, wore glasses. All these things that you shouldn't do as a ring. I had note cards with me that I was reading off of while I was standing. You know, like everything that you don't do as a ring announcer, I pretty much was doing that day. I remember Cornette pointing out that I had white socks on, so that was good. I had no clue what I was doing. I mean, no clue. I may have, like, if I shook anybody's hand that day, it was because they approached me. You know, I had absolutely no clue. But it got me started in wrestling, and luckily for me, Dennis and Angel Amoroso eventually both invited me back to be a ring announcer on their shows, and for the New Jack City shows also, and the AWC stuff. So I got my start on the East Coast, even though I lived in Chicago. So it was Dennis that gave me my first opportunity, though, which can be said for so many different people in wrestling, whether they're, you know, ring announcers, referees, managers, or wrestlers.
And, you know, you had been dealing with Mark, and now you're dealing with Dennis. What did you think of him when you first met him?
I don't know. Like, it's hard. It's hard for people that never were around him. It's hard to say. But I mean, it was Dennis. I mean, I kind of knew what to expect just because I had seen him on video and stuff before. So it's not like I'm meeting somebody that I have no concept of what he's like. He treated me really well, though. Like, I didn't get paid for that first show. Obviously, it was just, you know, if you want to do some matches, fine. But then when he had me back, he started paying me, and he was paying me really well, considering, like, it was probably because he realized I had to fly. Like, I was traveling. What I would do is I would fly to the East Coast for like 2 or 3 weeks and do a couple of weekends worth of shows, whether it's working a show as a ring announcer or just going to some ECW shows that I wanted to go to or whatever. And I just stay on the East Coast for a while. So he kind of knew that my expenses were more than your typical ring announcer that just, he lives in, you know, close by, that's driving to the show, and you give him $40 or whatever. So I was very grateful that he was helping on the flight a little bit. But, you know, he was always fair to me. A lot of people have horror stories about how he's one of the crooks in wrestling. You know, there are a lot of people that have tried to bury him over the years. And I like the fact that you guys are putting together lots of stories from different people on this podcast that shine a proper light on the things that Dennis did to help people. Because he did, like, there were a lot of people that had their early opportunities because of him. And because of his generosity, and because, you know, he probably saw a lot of himself as a wrestling fan in people like us, because, you know, we were showing such enthusiasm being around his shows at the time that they were happening. So he wanted to help us out, because he would have loved for the same thing to be happening to him, you know, as a young guy around wrestling.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I know you have a lot of stories about Dennis, but today we're going to focus on one particular tale. I don't know if it's one story or a group of stories combined.
Well, I mean, I think that it's best if I or someone from IWA Mid-South be the one to talk about the time that he and several people from the NWA did the invasion of IWA Mid-South. Because that was something that not as many people have knowledge of or have seen, because, I mean, it was very similar to what he did in Memphis with, you know, bringing Fred the Elephant Boy and his brother, you know, and all that stuff. And when he went to Smoky Mountain, but those were on television and therefore they're on YouTube and stuff like that. So people are more familiar with that, but he did the same thing at IWA Mid-South in 1997.
Well, before we get into that, just for our listeners, explain a little bit about where IWA Mid-South was at that point in time. And also, were you already involved with the company?
No. I started working IWA Mid-South. The shows that we're talking about happened during the summer of 97. And IWA Mid-South's first show ever was, I believe, November of 96. So they had just started running. It was in Louisville, Kentucky. He would run what used to be a Kmart building, where they took like maybe a quarter of the building and turned, and like he had somebody who was good, somebody who was good to, you know, like renovate little area. He like built his own little wrestling arena in a quarter of, in like one portion of the old Kmart building. Which is actually something that I am surprised that more independent promotions don't do.
This is Ian Rotten you're speaking of.
Yes, Ian Rotten. He was the promoter of IWA Mid-South. If you want to run weekly, and this was, you know, tail end of anybody still being able to run a weekly wrestling show and get people to actually show up, and toward the end of it, he didn't get people to show up, which was the problem. But for a while there, he was. Like, during late 96, 97, and through probably 98, he was drawing healthy crowds every week for shows, using a lot of, like, USWA guys that were on the outs with the USWA, and, you know, just hot indie talent, and you know, filling it out with, you know, blood and guts guys to fill out the rest of the show. So, you know, he was drawing sometimes, you know, 300 or 400 people every week for bigger shows. So that was, they were still in the first, you know, nine months of IWA existing, but it was a weekly, kind of like a, tried to run it like a territory. It wasn't, you know, he didn't have multiple cities every week, but he was running Louisville every week. And sometimes for big weekends, if he had talent in, he'd run a double shot and he'd do a show the night before in a different town or whatever to get the most out of paying the trans to have the names come in. So that was, I had met Ian at one of Dennis's shows. It was one of the Yardville shows. I think it was the April 96 Yardville, which was Ian Rotten versus Abudah Singh when Abdul the Butcher didn't show up.
Oh, that's one of the great Dennis moments of all time, where he gets on the ring, gets on the microphone and announces Abdullah no-showed. He's a piece of shit, and I'm going to assume in Atlanta.
I'm going to assume his ass Monday morning in Atlanta. trust me, I remember that very well. And then Abudah Singh hits the ring, and then this is your new main event. I remember Ian had the chicken pox a couple of weeks prior to that. Yet he was bleeding all over the building.
Oh.
I remember there was a big online controversy about how could you allow this to happen? And Dennis didn't know that he had the chicken pox, but well, Ian, he still did it. But whatever. Nobody
well,
does.
Also, there were much worse times in Ian's career for him to be bleeding on people.
Yes. Oh, boy. So I had met Ian at that show, and that was early 96. And I remember he invited me to be a part of IWA from the very beginning, but I couldn't do it because I was in school at the time. And so I couldn't come. So this was the first opportunity to really come down there. I had wanted to be a part of the thing from the very beginning, but I just couldn't do it. But since I was working for Dennis, he was like, all right, well, if you want to come down for this weekend, you could be aligned with Dennis and, you know, the NWA people. I'm like, okay, sounds good. So my first show for IWA Mid-South was the show that Dennis made his first appearance on in July of 97.
All right. And what's the story behind that? So Dennis goes in there as the leader of the NWA, I assume.
Yes, I did find the tape of this just to refresh my memory. So I've told the story before, I think on Bix's old, like when you briefly did your own podcast several years ago.
Yes,
as I recall,
the original one.
I think I told the story on this, and I mixed two different shows together as one, but it was actually separate occasions. The first time they came in, which I found the tape of and tried to watch before we recorded this, just to refresh my memory, but like it is horrible, like 7-Eleven surveillance mode camera on a tripod with a terrible microphone, so like you really can't tell much of what is being said. But I got enough to separate the two shows and what happened on each show in my mind apart from one another. So the first show, it was Les Thatcher was kind of like the commissioner of IWA at the time. So the show starts with Ian and Les Thatcher in the ring, and they welcome Dennis and Mark Coraluzzo to the ring, and they come out to the ring in suits and ties with sunglasses on. And Ian and Les announce to everybody that, you know, it's a very important day because, you know, a company with such rich history, the NWA, IWA Mid-South is joining the NWA, and we're very happy and we're welcoming, he said the president of the NWA, but I think it was just the vice president at the time, president of the NWA, Dennis Coraluzzo and his son, Mark, and welcome to IWA. And before you know it, and the tape cuts out for some reason right after that. And that, like, it cuts out, and you could tell it was stopped for some reason, then started again. And it goes from the crowd being like very calm and just watching what's going on, to once it's back on, suddenly they're getting mad heat and people are like throwing shit at the ring. And I don't know. So I don't know what was said. Probably it was just, he handed him the mic. He's like, yeah, thank you. Yeah. You guys are a bunch of pieces of shit. Yeah. You're all rednecks, blah, blah, blah. So he just starts cutting everybody down. And, so basically that established the NWA as evil. And then what they ended up doing was they came back. That first trip, there was like Billy Real, Gino Moore, Dennis, I think maybe Tom Brandy, maybe one of the Lost Boys. I think they went down for that trip and did one show. And then the plan was then some of the IWA guys would come up and work maybe a weekend of shows in New Jersey to further the story, even though neither promotion had real TV or anything at the time. And then come back down. And then when they came back down in September was the story that really has made the rounds. So they were the heel invading force, bringing NWA guys down to work with IWA in South. So they came back. I wasn't at the show when they eventually came up and did something in New Jersey, and I don't think that it drew very well. Were you at that one, Brian?
I don't think I was. I remember Dennis invited me to, I think, the second time they went down, and I didn't go. And I kind of wish I had.
Yeah, you should have.
But, the only thing I remember, you said that there was no television, so the feud really couldn't grow. The only place you could really read about it would be in Jess McGrath's column in The Lariat.
Yeah, Jess was there. He came to those shows. I remember sitting next to him at, like, the sound table during the shows as it was happening. So... yeah, a lot of people just relied on the internet at the time to find out what was going, like recaps of shows. If you didn't get a tape of the show, you had to rely on who did the write-up. And Jess was really, he was like one of those guys that did complete write-ups on everything. And I think that perhaps him doing that full write-up on his trips to IWA was what maybe got some eyeballs focused on what Ian was doing at the time, because there weren't many people that were, you know, in Louisville, Kentucky that like were on RSPW or, you know, reporting on stuff. There was a guy that eventually started doing like a little online newsletter. His name, they called him Mac Daddy Mike. He started doing that, to get the word out, get results out and stuff like that. But Jess was a big help early on in spreading the IWA. But anyway, when they came back down, it was the weekend that Princess Diana had passed away in the horrible car accident. And I don't know why. Like, this doesn't really make any sense when you really think about it. But hey, Princess Diana dies in England. So we have an independent wrestling show in Louisville, Kentucky. Let's do a 10 bell, or let's do a moment of silence for Princess Diana before we start the show. Of course, why not? Because she took so many bumps over the years and contributed so much to those WrestleManias. Yeah. So, okay, so we had a moment of silence, and everybody, like, stood up, like, start the show. Everybody stands up, takes off their hats, bows their heads in a moment of silence for Princess Diana. And Dennis Coraluzzo had a live microphone behind the curtain. And I couldn't find this tape. The tape does exist. I'll try to dig it up so that you guys can please post something on YouTube. So I may have the exact wording wrong, but it was something along the lines of, "Yo, fuck that bitch." And it's like moves across the sound system, and suddenly everybody's booing as he makes his way to the ring. And he says something along the lines of, "They wouldn't have crashed if she wasn't performing oral sex on the driver as they were driving." And then proceeds to go on his tirade about pro wrestling and IWA Mid-South. But that the moment will always stay in anybody's mind that was there that day, that everyone moment of silence for Princess Diana, and Dennis just interrupts it in the most obnoxious way possible. But another thing that popped me that I thought was that I mixed together with that first appearance and the second was there was a whole section of the bleachers at the IWA shows that consisted of either just plain old rats or the girlfriends of the wrestlers on the shows. It was very much a community like that, much like most territories where, like, if you knew who all the wrestlers were, there were probably the same girls around every show, too. So there was like a whole rat section of bleachers. And on that first show, I watched this before we recorded, Dennis and Mark are, you know, they're cutting the promo on Ian and Les Thatcher and everything. And then they start talking about the fans and then they start singling out the rats and they explain what a rat is, you know, it's a girl that hangs around wrestling just to have sex with the wrestlers and spread disease and blah, blah, blah. You got all you girls right over here, nothing but a bunch of rats. So you know what? Here's some cheese. And he digs into a bag and starts throwing hunks of cheese into the bleachers, which they catch and start throwing back at Dennis and Mark and Gino Moore inside the ring. And I'm like, that's great. Throwing cheese at the rats. So he had a great way of, he might not have been the most well-spoken promo in wrestling history, but it's always entertaining, whether he was talking about how Tracy Smothers is really Vito Marinara on Smoky Mountain TV, or whether he's talking about, you know, Kamala on the USWA TV, or about how Jerry's kids, these are Jerry's kids. He might, you know, maybe he was grabbing the microphone out of Dave Brown's hand instead of letting him hold it for him. So he wasn't like the most experienced television character, but he could get great heat because he knew the right things to say. And the right thing to say to rile up that crowd at IWA was to call those girls a bunch of rats and throw cheese at them. So that's exactly what they did. But for that second trip, I remember Reckless Youth came down and won the light heavyweight title from the American Kickboxer, and Donnie B managed the IWA crew on that second trip. The Misfits were down there. Trying to remember who else. I don't know. Those are the names that come to mind, but they were fun trips. It was all during the summer. It was, you know, July and September of 97. So I drove down with Scott Lemmer, who's one of the referees for Carmine Despirito's promotion in Milwaukee. So we made the trip from the Chicago area and they made the trip from the East Coast. And so, you know, I got to hang out with Dennis and Mark and, you know, Reckless in a different setting other than Dennis at Dennis's shows. So that was a fun time,
man. That I hadn't thought about that whole show in a long time. I think I've laughed more right now than I have in a long time here on the program.
Throwing cheese at the rats. And and Gino Moore, I mean, you could tell they went shopping before this whole thing, because Gino Moore had a giant helium filled Mickey Mouse balloon. Obviously, for the visual, you are rats. This is a mouse. You are rats.
Man, please dig up these tapes.
I definitely have that one, but I mean, it's gonna have to. Deal with. I mean, the tape that I found, it's like I said, 7-Eleven surveillance mode, but it's ringside. Can't really hear much, but as long as you see, you could get the visual for a few seconds of what they are and throwing the cheese and stuff. I'll definitely be able to find that and capture it and YouTube that. The other one, and I asked Adam Lash, who is another collector of all things independent wrestling on video from that period of time. I was like, do you have any better tape of the September show with the Princess Diana thing? And he's like, nope, I've got, it's like up in the balcony, 7-Eleven surveillance mode camera. So it's like bird's eye view of the whole building. So like, you really can't see anything, but maybe you can hear exactly what was said. And I have to find that tape. I've got it somewhere, but, I'll definitely be able to at least put the throwing the cheese at the rats up on YouTube tonight.
Well, we definitely are going to have you back on again, because I know you have more Dennis stories, and this was a lot of fun to talk to you about this stuff.
Oh, and during that trip, I probably shouldn't say this, but you could.
But you better. Now you should.
on Bix's podcast the first time a couple of years ago, during one of those trips, he mentioned how they had to be, I mean, this adds more to the, he was kind of like the Sopranos, you know, the real life Sopranos, but in pro wrestling, where he showed me a McDonald's bag filled with $100 bills. He's like, yeah, we had to make a little bit of a stop on the way here to collect some money. I'm like, what? I don't want to know anymore. And I didn't get any more specifics, but I'm just saying, Dennis, it was Dennis. I don't know what he may have bought or sold, or collected for someone else in New Jersey at the time. But yeah, it came in handy that he was passing through certain states at that period of time, I guess. I don't know. It added to the legendariness of Dennis Corluzzo in my mind, though. So you never really know what all he might have been involved with.
Well, before we go, anything you're thinking about talking about on the next time you're on?
Okay, there's a few things. There was now during that period where I was ring announcing and living in Chicago and working for Dennis, I was trying to do, like I said, trying to do everything that I could to spread the word about these shows, whether it be on the internet or doing the hotlines or whatever. So I was actually trying to set up sold shows for him in the Chicago area, because I remember that he, you know, he came out and co-promoted that show with Eddie Sharkey, two of them, with Eddie Sharkey in the Twin Cities. The
Grand Slam. Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, you already came out to the Midwest and did that one thing. And I remember, I don't know if he had much to do with some of those NWA things in Michigan that I guess Sabu eventually, Pee Wee Moore and Sabu kind of spearheaded. But those were called NWA shows at the time. So I'm like, if I can get some sold shows, let's do this, you know? So what he did, he had he called it a kit that he used, a sales kit to get sold shows from high schools or, you know, whatever, to try to get a sponsor to buy a wrestling show for like $8,000. And it's a packet, you know, of documents that would describe what you get in a wrestling show and talent available and everything involved. So I think that just that, if I take that packet and I scan it and send it to you guys, we could probably just spend a period of time just discussing how he's got sold shows. So I'll dig that up for the future. We could talk about something like that. And, you know, I didn't work for Dennis for that long of a period of time. I mean, I probably only did a total of maybe 15 shows ish for him, you know, because I didn't live on the East Coast. It was just during trips that I would make out there. But, you know, he did the most in that first year and a half to help me in wrestling. So I was very thankful. And I always, you know, till the very end, you know, when I'd talk to him on the phone, you know, right up till the last shows that he promoted, like the Garden State shows or whatever that he was helping with. But, you know, he great guy, and I really like the fact that you guys are doing these Dennis of the Weeks, because and there's a lot of stories that I have heard, but there's a lot that I haven't. So I look forward to hearing everybody else tell their tales of Dennis Corluzzo in future weeks.
So after we recorded that segment with Dave Prazak, and boy, that was a lot of fun, and we can't wait to have him back on the show again. He sent me a video clip, and I'm right now trying to get the permission to put this up. It is a video from Smart Mark Video of Dennis and the first night of the NWA invasion in IWA Mid-South. And the story Dave tells is funny. The video is absolutely insane. It is absolutely insane. And the heat they get from this crowd is out of control. And I am right now actively trying to get permission so that by the time you hear this show, hopefully we'll have an official 605 video of this up, and it'll say it in the video, but I'm going to say it right now. The video is from Smart Mark Video, so check them out for this. But I'm going to try to get this up. It's from July 19th, 1997.
And Smart Mark Video, regardless of even if this doesn't happen, good people. I mean, good place to buy indie wrestling videos. Does everyone who they do business with right? So just wanted to get that out there.
Yeah. Sounds like they're good people. They did the Dennis Corluzzo shoot interview in 2000, which I got to get my hands on. I used to have it. I have it on videotape somewhere. I need to actually get it in a format I can actively watch on my computer. But that thing was insane. That thing was so great. And Dennis did a little special surprise impersonation of a fan known to many people in Philadelphia at the very end of it, which is just over the top. Mm-hmm. Really great stuff. But again, I'm going to try to get this video up because the story's great. But when you see the video, it is like nothing you've ever seen before. It's total Corluzzo. And I say that in the greatest possible way. And the other thing that becomes apparent when you watch the video, as good as Dennis is, Mark, my old friend Mark Corluzzo, his son, is awesome as just a young kid there in the ring as a heel with his dad. He's great too. I wish he had done more of this kind of stuff. He's really good in the role. But That's it for that. Is there anything else we're missing this mixing? Is there anything else we're missing this week, Bix, that you think we should get to?
Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, this is the weird episode. I think we're going to be normal length this week, and yes, we'll see if we could go past that barrier again next week when we have our special guest on the show. But yeah, I guess it's time for plugs. Before we do anything, Bix, you have anything on the plate?
I got a couple things. The new Figure Four Weekly that's out when you read this will have an article I did about the testing thing that Daniel Bryan did, that, you know, where they found the lesion on in his brain that was causing his seizures or whatever it was. Anyway, I talked to the people at the company, interviewed them, made sure I did some research, had some help with that to kind of explain what the testing is, how it works, and explain kind of what they said as far as the things that people were skeptical about, etc. And I like how that came out, that it think it should finally be up by the time you hear this. The newsletter was late this week for various reasons. You know, Vinny was on vacation, and, you know,
did
Brian's
you say
wife spawned.
Did you say vacation?
No, vacation. Oh, I should have said Brian spawned, and then I started to say Brian's wife had a baby, and then I wanted to go back to the joke, and I realized it sounded terrible because now I said Whitney had a spawn. So
I have to send Brian a note. I haven't talked to him in a little while, but I want to definitely wish him congratulations.
Yes, mazel tov to our friend Brian Alvarez.
Yes.
And Whitney. So that's this week's. Next week's I'm going to – because it's the start of the Hulk Hogan Gawker trial. This week is jury selection. Next week the actual trial starts. I'm going to lay out the whole Gawker defense and how that works and kind of the details that maybe haven't really been explained as much. And it's actually very interesting as far as how they expect to argue that the whole Hogan sex tape thing was an issue of public concern. So there's that. And of course, all my like regular day-to-day ongoing coverage of the trial, and including some of the jury selection and other related stuff, is at sescoops.com. And the only other thing for now that I'll push is this week's Between the Sheets. Me and Chris Zellner had on Matt Farmer for part of the show covering the week of Super Bowl II. I almost said Super Bowl III for some reason.
Yeah, what's going on? How come you guys can't hold on to a guest through the show?
Shenanigans. I don't know. And that was kind of my idea, to do a leap year, since this was a leap year, and the only big wrestling event that I can think of that happened on leap day is Super Bowl II, which is fine week. You know, lots of stuff going on between that and Luger leaving WCW and the WWF scandals starting to kick off and all sorts of stuff there. So check that out on the PWO-PTBN podcast feed, and I guess that's it. We'll do Twitter at the end for both of us with everything else. So what do you have to plug this week?
Well, as always, I am the co-host on the Jim Cornette Experience at MLWRadio.com. You can download it from iTunes, or if you want to go to their website, you could do that too. And this week, Jim and I have a fun talk about various topics. And we start diving into wrestling a little bit. And then I have my first interactions on the air with Kenny Bolin. And that is rather interesting. I would say that, Bix, a lot of people think that Kenny is just like working some gimmick when he's on Cornette's show. I could tell you he's like living a gimmick as opposed to performing a gimmick, because before we even started recording, him and Jim were going at it, and it was Kenny the same way you would hear him on the air. And of course, me and him ended up really, you know, not seeing eye to eye, let's say, on the show this week. So if you ever wanted to hear me have an argument, an inane, insipid argument with Kenny Bolin, this was your chance. With that said, Kenny may be on our show pretty soon, not to do any shtick or anything, but actually talk about Dennis Carluzzo. So he has some Dennis stories. But my first interactions with Kenny, so if you're a fan of Kenny, you may like it. If not, you may not. But you can check that out on the Jim Cornette Experience. With that, we also have, as Bix said earlier, for our book of the week, tinyurl.com/605Amazon. Anything you buy on Amazon, use our link. We get a little bit of a kickback. Helps us keep the show going. Helps us build our self-esteem. Helps us feel that we have some value to the world. So help us out. We're Jews. We like money. And on Twitter, don't forget, whenever you have conversations, to use the hashtag 605pod. and we'll be able to keep up with what's going on out there in the Twitterverse. Also on iTunes, if you download us from iTunes, or even if you don't and you have an iTunes account, please leave us a positive review, a 5-star review, and write a review. 5 stars like your favorite matches, like Rick Ratchet against Steve Corino, and Ric Flair versus Ricky Steamboat, and David Bixenspan and Akeem Bixenspan versus the Slip House Boys. All your favorite matches, just like those. Leave us a 5-star review if you would. It would we would very much appreciate it. And my God, I think I got through all the plugs. Am I missing anything?
No, you didn't. Facebook.com/superpodcast.
Son of a
Facebook page.
Yes,
we post. We post our friend Travis's artwork for the show there. That's where we've been taking some questions and stuff. We try to interact with everyone. So that's at facebook.com/superpodcast, since for some reason 605 pod was taken by some Japanese guy.
Yeah, it works out better this way.
And of course, follow us both on Twitter. I am at David Bix. Brian, you are at?
Twitter.
No, you're at Great Brian Last. You tried that joke already.
It works every time in my eyes. It makes me laugh every time you build it up and think I'm not going to do it. And then I hit you with it again.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's Larry Nelson at on Twitter? There you go. So you can join Larry on Twitter and hear more of that. More of the grunting and groaning. And until next week, boy, this has been a hell of a show we've done today, Bix. Oh, man. This is the difference.
Hell is the operative word.
This is the difference between recording late at night and recording early in the day like we're doing today, where we're both completely awake and just our brains are all over the place. And, yeah, that's it for this week. Next week, we expect to have a guest on the show and maybe a second guest for the Dentist of the Week. But until next time, he's David Bixenspan. I'm the Great Brian Last. We'll see you next week. Tally-ho!
Alley-oop dream machine. He had his ups and downs, as you well saw there. And sometimes was like that comic book character, the dream machine, who is the current Southern heavyweight champ, as a matter of fact. And Jimmy Hart.
What's wrong with you, man? What the hell's the matter with you? You will be tarred and feathered. You will be tarred and feathered. I'll kill you, Lala. Nobody makes me look like a cartoon.
Jimmy Hart, the dream machine, he's fired. $1,000 right here. You'll pay it or you won't wrestle here today or tomorrow, no other time.
Okay, Eddie, Lance, I'm sorry.
I'm not paying you nothing. Get him out of here, Hart.
Just take him
out. The hell with you. I'm not paying you nothing.
If he don't pay today,
I'm not paying you nothing. Come on,
come on. Idiot.
He didn't mean it. I'm sorry. Okay, he didn't mean it. Okay.
Yeah, he didn't mean it. All right, get out of here. We'll be back.